realize was that Chrysalis had her own priorities. She didn't want to destroy Hartman. She just liked the idea of maybe having a little leverage over our next president. And me? I got to thinking, too. I mean, I write the story, it's a big sensation, maybe I win a Pulitzer. But a year from now, who cares? Maybe there was a better way. Presidents need press secretaries, right? I could do that. Get a little respect. I wouldn't have Tachyon pouring drinks over my head or irate boyfriends punching me in the mouth. I might even get a decent table at Aces High, he sighed. You gotta remember, we knew Hartman was an ace. We even guessed he had some kind of hinky mind control. But that was it. So maybe he made Kahina slice her brother's throat from ear to ear that day in Sirius, so what? Better his neck than mine, right? And the nerve was going to off all of us. So you thought Hartman was a good guy, Jay prompted. Downs nodded. We set up a meeting, he said gloomily. He looked off into the distance, toward Orlami, remembering. We thought we had the situation under control. We were wrong. His voice had gotten very somber. Oh man, were we wrong, he said. That was when Greg and Mackie Messer put on their little show. Hartman knew everything. Don't ask me how. The hunchback delivered Kahina in a tarp, naked, covered with blood. He told us how he'd already raped her in the ass. And he went to work on her, humming, Mack the knife, the whole time. When he was done, he walked out through a wall. Even talking about it made Downs go shaky. If Hartman's everything you say, why didn't he have his killer eliminate you and Chrysalis right then? Well, he didn't want two more deaths to explain. Instead, he put us in charge of the cover-up. He told Chrysalis to get rid of the body and warned me that if anything appeared in the press, even hinting that he was an ace, Mackie would come for me. And you went along with this shit? Jay could maybe believe it of Digger, but Chrysalis hated being told what to do. He couldn't imagine her being easy to intimidate. You weren't there, Digger snapped. Hartman's little leather boy walks through walls, man. I checked up on him afterward. He's German, part of the gang who grabbed Hartman in Berlin, but somehow Greg turned him around and made a house pet of him. If I will get you 10, he's the one that made sushi of the other kidnappers. Interpol's still hunting his twisted little ass. Then why not tell the cops? Digger laughed bitterly. Oh, yeah. Go tell them that the former chairman of Scare is in league with the terrorist who helped kidnap him. Right. And pray that word don't leak to Greg. Except it always does, somehow. Either he's a mind reader, or he's got one working for him. I don't know. The point is, we couldn't trust no one. Chrysalis had some idea about getting Yeoman to help us out, but she was never able to get in touch with him. So we just played along and stayed alive. Until Monday, Jay said. The name George Kirby mean anything to you? Downs shook his head. She wasn't talking to anybody near the end. I don't even think she trusted me. It made sense, Jay thought. The fewer people who knew, the fewer people who could betray her. But if Digger was telling the truth, someone had betrayed her anyway. And fast. She'd barely set her plan in motion, and she'd been lying dead on her office floor. Hartman, if that was who it was, didn't waste any time. What about the jacket? Jay asked. The jacket, Digger said. He snapped his fingers. She kept it, hidden somewhere. It was her last line of defense, she said. It was like a stalemate. If we went public with all we had, we'd be killed. But Hartman had to watch out, too. If he left us with nothing to lose, we could use the jacket and bring him down.
Real good, said Jay.
So where is this jacket? In a safe place, Downs said, with a helpless shrug. That's all she'd say. I told you she didn't trust no one. Have you checked her closets?
No, said Jay, remembering what Brennan had told him. but I know someone who has. How much do you know about the oddity?
7 p.m. Father Squid was standing in front of Our Lady of Perpetual Misery when Brennan and Jennifer arrived.
You're the last, the priest told him. If you'll follow me, we can begin the reading. Our Quasiman guards against unwanted interruptions.
Fine, Brennan said. But before we go in, I have a favor to ask of Quasiman. Where is he? Father Squid pointed up. The crippled joker was standing at the top of the steeple, casually leaning against the metal spiral that projected from the base of the spire. He was looking far away at things neither Brennan, nor Jennifer, nor Father Squid could see. Can you get him down? Brennan asked. Father Squid shrugged massive shoulders.
I can try.
He looked up, cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted,
Quasiman!
The joker made no sign that he heard. Father Squid sighed and shouted again, louder. This time Quasiman looked down. He let go of the spiral, waved, and started to slip down the steeply inclined surface of the steeple. Jennifer gasped, but just as Quasiman slid off into empty space, he disappeared. There was a distinct popping sound. Then he was standing next to Brennan and Jennifer on the sidewalk in front of the church.
Yes,
he said. Brennan stared at him for a moment. I wanted to ask you a favor, he finally said.
A favor?
Quasiman repeated. Yes. You know that I'm trying to find out who killed Chrysalis. Well, I'm having a problem with an ace, an extraordinarily strong ace. I may need your help in handling him. Quasiman glanced at Father Squid, who nodded almost imperceptibly.
All right.
Thanks. Brennan held up a small electronic unit, the size and thickness of a folded wallet. When, if, we need you, we'd be able to call you with this. Quasiman took the receiver dubiously.
All right.
He looked at the unit, his look lengthening into a stare as his mind drifted away to wherever it went when he phased out.
You know, Father Squid said, Quasiman is not the most reliable of men.
He'll have to do. There's no one else to turn to. Brennan didn't mention the other reason he wanted Quasiman to carry the receiver. It was also a sensitive sending unit. He planned to monitor Quasiman to see if he had any contact with someone who might have wanted Chrysalis dead.
Very well, Father Squid said as Quasiman suddenly returned to normal. But now, the will.
They went into the church, leaving Quasiman outside on the sidewalk. The first four rows of pews were filled with people who worked at the Crystal Palace, from Jojo the microcephalic joker who swept out the place, to Charles Dutton, the skull-faced man who was Chrysalis's silent partner. Only Elmo and Sasha were missing. Elmo because he was still being held by the police. Joe Jory was also present. As Brennan and Jennifer approached the pew where Jory sat by himself, he knocked back a drink from a silver pocket flask. Brennan couldn't tell if grief was making him drink to excess, or the thought of being so close to so many jokers. Either way, Brennan found it hard to be sorry for him. Father Squid settled his immense bulk down behind the table set up before the rail and looked around expectantly as all whispered conversations stopped.
I'm glad that you all come to hear Chrysalis's last will and testament. This reading is not for outsiders. The lawyers weren't told of it, neither were the police. Those formalities will be taken care of later. Tonight is for Chrysalis's family.
Father Squid picked up a manila envelope, slipped out a sheaf of papers, and tapped them together into a neat stack.
As was my duty, I have already gone over Chrysalis's will once in private. I will read it to you now.
He cleared his throat, then began.
I, Chrysalis, being of sound mind and as sound a body as I've had since the wild card changed me, give you my last will and testament. I have numerous bequests to make, Father, so please gather together everyone connected with the Crystal Palace, and a few others whom I know you know, but will be nameless here. First, to Father Squid and the Church of Jesus Christ, Joker, I leave the contents of the luggage locker that fits the key which you'll find in this envelope. I know you will put it to good use.
Father Squid looked up.
this has already been taken care of. Second to Elmo Schaefer, my right hand since I first came alone to the city, I give you what I could not give you in life, my love. If ever there was a man who deserved it, it was you.
The priest sighed, cleared his throat again, and went on.
Third, to Charles Dutton, I give outright my share of the Crystal Palace.
There was an audible intake of collective breath, and half a dozen conversations broke out. The Father Squid's powerful voice hushed.
With the proviso that everything stays exactly as it is, and everyone keeps their jobs as long as they shall live.
Dutton inclined his head, and a wave of relief swept over the room.
Fourth, to Digger Downs I leave the coat. Wear it in good health, or use it as you will.
Perhaps, Brennan thought, the oddity was searching for this coat in Chrysalis's closet. Though what role a coat could play in Chrysalis's murder was utterly beyond Brennan.
Fifth, to my loving father, if he has bothered to attend this reading.
Father Squid stood and passed a large manila envelope to Jory. He took it with shaking hands, broke the seal, and slipped out a sheet of heavy paper 8 by 10 inches. Brennan could see from where he was sitting that it was the famous Annie Leibovitz photograph of Chrysalis. She was naked from the waist up, and you could almost see her blood race, her lungs pump, her heart throb to the pulse of her life.
So that you will remember your darling little girl, day in and day out, the priest continued in his remorseless voice, as long as you shall live.
It was a gift with a sharp but just edge to it, Brennan thought. Once, in what was probably the most vulnerable mood he'd ever seen her in, Chrysalis had told him that the virus had manifested itself in her at puberty. Her family had then locked her away in a wing of their mansion. They kept her hidden in their shame and disgust until she'd managed to escape 6 years later. Father Squid sat back down behind his table. The church was silent, but for the sobbing the jury couldn't muffle by covering his face with his shaking hands.
Sixth, to my archer. If he has heard of my death and cared enough to attend this meeting, I leave two things. The first...
Brennan stood and reached out a steady hand to take the small envelope that the priest held out. He opened it. Inside was a small bit of plastic laminated paper, 2¼ by 3½ inches, a brand new, crisp, clean ace of spades.
To place on the body of my murderer. The second to toast to offers I should have accepted. Promises I should have made.
Father Squid picked up a box from the floor and placed it on the table.
I'm sorry, he said in his gentle voice. It seems that a vandal broke into Chrysalis's bedroom and smashed most everything, this included. I can dispose of it if you'd like.
It was the decanter she kept by her bedside filled with the Irish whiskey that Brennan favored. Thank you, Father. I'll take it. There were more bequests. Most everyone was given a little something that they needed, or perhaps just something that they wanted, but could never have afforded. Everyone was touched by the depths of feeling there was to the woman who had known everything, it seemed, and showed nothing. Brennan wondered again, Jennifer's hand a comforting presence on his right forearm, what would have happened if Chrysalis had taken the offer of his protection, had given him the promise of her love. He looked at Jennifer, wondering if she could read the questions in his eyes. The reading ended. There were tears of sadness and genuine grief as Father Squid moved among the palace employees, comforting them with his gentle, stolid presence. Jory had ceased sobbing and had passed out drunk. Father Squid detailed Lupo to get him to his hotel room. As everyone stood about chatting, Brennan thought he felt eyes on him, as if someone were waiting in ambush in the rear of the church. He glanced back and saw a huge, bulky figure, dressed in a floor-length cloak, slip out of the back of the choir loft. He handed the box with a broken decanter in it to Jennifer. Take this to the room and wait for me. There's someone I have to see right now. She nodded and took the package from him.
Be careful, she said.
But Brennan was already out in the night, following the oddity, as that mysterious entity went on its mysterious rounds.
9 p.m. The oddity wasn't listed in the phone book or in the city directory, at least not under Oddity. The Joker had other names, Evan, Patty, John. That much Digger had remembered from that story that Mr. Lowboy had refused to print. The oddity wasn't one person, but three. Two men and a woman. They'd been roommates and lovers, Digger told him. A menage a trois. Until the wild card had fused them into a single nightmare creature. Three minds sharing one massive body. Its flesh alive with the agony of perpetual transformation. Evan, Patty, John. But no surnames. As for an address, the best that Downs could recall was that they lived down in Jokertown somewhere. That much Jay could have guessed by himself. He took a cab to Jokertown and hit the streets, making the rounds until his feet began to hurt. The snitches at Freakers gave him some leads, after he dropped a few bills, but nothing had panned out. The oddity didn't drink in any of the usual gin joints, eat in any of the usual greasy spoons, or get his or her ashes hauled in any of the usual cat houses. Jay finally tried the cop house, ducking in through the side entrance to avoid his buddies, Miseric and Kant. There had been rumors about the oddity, Sergeant Mole told him, but no complaints, no arrests, and no address on file. After that, he walked the streets at random, in the half-assed hope of bumping into his quarry. When he hadn't been looking for the oddity, the asshole had been showing up everywhere. Now he couldn't find him for a prayer. It must have been old habit that made Jay turn down Henry Street toward the Crystal Palace. He was half a block away when he remembered the palace was closed. Except he saw when he got closer that it wasn't. Jay shoved in through the front door, following a pair of slumming yuppies. The taproom was as crowded as he'd ever seen it. All the tables and booths were full, and patrons were lined up too deep along the bar, clamoring for service. Jay moved through the press with a couple of feints and a deft elbow to belly up to the rail. Lupo was the only bartender. His fur was slick with sweat, and he looked harassed.
I got his Poise Café for him right here, he snapped at the waitress, grabbing his crotch.
He drew a beer and set it on her tray.
Here, give him this. If he doesn't like it, tell him Squisher makes the best Poise Café in town, over in the basement.
The bartender caught sight of Jay from the corner of his eye. He threw together a scotch and soda and brought it down, walking right past four gnat barflies who were trying to get his attention. Son of a fucking bitch, he complained, as he set down the drink on a soggy coaster in front of Jay.
Busy tonight, Jay said. Tell me about it, Lupo said. Nothing like a murder to goose up business. I never seen three quarters of these geeks before. Let me tell you, they don't know jack about tipping, neither.
Hey, one of the gnats screamed from three stools down.
Hey, Furface, I want some fucking service.
Lupo turned his head and snarled, baring long yellow teeth. The gnat cringed and almost fell off his stool. For a second, it got very quiet along the bar. Lupo turned back to Jay. You were saying?
Where's Sasha? Jay asked. Good question, Lupo said. This is his goddamn shift.
Only nobody can find him. Maybe if I was a telepath, I'd know when to get lost, too.
New boss on the premises?
Lupo nodded, moving off as a waitress hailed him from the far end of the bar. Try the Red Room, he said. The Red Room was quieter than the main tap room, but all the booths were occupied, red velvet curtains drawn around each for privacy. Jay stopped the waitress and asked about Dutton. She pointed to the booth on the end. He carried his scotch over and stuck his head through the curtain.
Peek-a-boo, he said.
Jube jumped like someone had given him a hot foot and looked nervous until he saw who it was. Charles Dutton seemed unperturbed.
Have a seat, Mr. Ackroyd, he said calmly.
Jay slid into the booth and let the curtain fall closed behind him, shutting them into a soft red womb. It felt good to sit down. Dutton was nursing a cognac. The walrus had a huge piña colada with a pineapple ring floating on top, but he pushed it away and maneuvered his bulk out of the booth.
I gotta sell some papers, he said. Catch you later.
Jay waited till he was gone. Picking up the pieces? Deep-sunk, cold eyes regarded him frankly.
You might say that. I've decided to keep the business going.
Great, Jay said. I'll be your first customer.
What would you like to know? If the price is right, I'm sure we can do business.
I get my usual generous discount, right? Jay said. He went on quickly before Dutton could say no. I'm looking for the oddity. Know where they live?
No, Dutton said.
Jay made a tisking sound. Chrysalis would have, he said.
See, if you're going to be an information broker, you got to know things like that.
Give me time to consult her informants, Dutton said.
Sasha might know, Jay told him.
You pick up all kinds of things when you can read minds. Where is Sasha, anyway?
I would like to know that myself. He hasn't returned to his room since the murder. His mother hasn't seen him either. She's quite worried.
He's probably with his girlfriend, Jay said. Trust me, she's not the kind of girl you bring home to Mom. He finished his drink.
Guess you haven't found those secret files yet.
No, more's the pity, Dutton told him.
I can assure you, however, that they're nowhere in this building.
Dutton pulled his hood over his face and stood up.
Don't tell me you're tired of my company already, Jay said.
I'm afraid I have business to attend to.
Me too.
Jay got to his feet.
He was thinking about Sasha. The last time he'd paid a call, he'd gotten laid and lied to. Maybe it was time they had another chat.
10 p.m. It was a cinch to follow the oddity, no matter how crowded or how empty the streets. The Joker didn't move very fast, and he certainly had a conspicuous silhouette. Things got a little trickier when the oddity took the deserted back alleys, where there were no other pedestrians to blend in with. But the alleys were also darker than the streets, and allowed Brennan to move from shadow to shadow with the stealth of a stalking cat. The oddity finally stopped before a back service entrance of a dark brick building, and let himself in with a key. Brennan followed him as closely as he dared. He stopped before the metal door, pausing to read the legend stenciled on it. Service Entrance, Famous Bowery Wildcard Dime Museum. Brennan frowned, wondering what connection the oddity could have with the Wildcard Museum. He went to work on the door, knowing he wouldn't find any answers out there in the alley. Inside, the museum was dimly lit by security lights that threw the various exhibits into shadowy relief. Brennan felt a touch of strangeness as he moved by the silent, dimly lit replicas of aces and jokers and aliens. It was a relief finally to hear the sound of clumping feet that put him back on the oddity's trail. He caught up to the oddity as the Joker was disappearing down a flight of stairs that led to the bowels of the museum. Brennan followed him down the stairs and caught up with him again as he entered what looked like a basement workroom. The Joker had flicked on all the lights, so Brennan cautiously hid behind a tarp-covered something that was being stored in the wide hallway. From his vantage point, he could peer around the door jamb and see into most of the room, which was largely filled with half-completed wax replicas. The oddity was pacing before one of the wax sculptures. Brennan leaned further into the light and saw that it was a nude study of Chrysalis. Her torso was just starting to take form, with bones and organs gleaming under wispy musculature. Her head was still a formless blob. The oddity suddenly took off his fencing mask and hurled it across the room with an anguished howl. It made a loud clatter as it smashed into a pile of pots and pails that were sitting near the wall. The oddity, now wearing the sensitive features of a handsome black man whose face was twisted by intense emotion, continued to pace before the sculpture. Brennan was so engrossed in watching the Joker that he almost didn't hear the footsteps on the stairs. He managed to jerk back into the darkness just as Charles Dutton came down the hallway and went into the workroom where the oddity was pacing.
"I thought it was you," Brennan heard Dutton say.
There was a long silence, then Dutton added,
"There's no sense brooding over it, Evan."
Brennan heard the oddity suck in a long, angry breath.
"She's dead, Charles. Beaten to a pulp by some lousy ace. I'll never finish it now."
There was the sound of more angry pacing than the oddity, Evan, said,
I'd love to get my hands on the neck of the son of a bitch who did it to her. I would. I really would.
Now, Evan, Dutton said placatingly, that's not like you at all. Sounds more like John. We have plenty of other things to worry about. The police are on the case, and so is Aykroyd. Someone will find the murderer. Let's concentrate on the files.
I know, Charles, Evan said as Brennan silently backed away down the hall. I know, but why Chrysalis? Who could have done such a thing?
Brennan went back up the stairs, through the museum, and out into the alley by the back door. There'd been no mistaking the pain and anguish in the oddity's voice, though Brennan was unsure if he was more upset about Chrysalis's death or his unfinished waxwork. In any case, unless the oddity was even more schizoid than Brennan figured, it was obvious that he hadn't killed Chrysalis. The oddity was innocent, Brennan thought. So was Bludgeon. The shadow fists were looking better and better. He checked his wristwatch as he moved off into the night. Time to call a man, he thought, about a visit to a graveyard.
This time Jay decided not to ring the doorbell. Just thinking of Azili gave him a hard-on. But last visit, things had gotten entirely too messy for his taste. He pushed an empty dumpster down the alley and climbed on top. From there, his fingers could brush the lowest rung of the ladder that hung down from the old cast-iron fire escape. He stretched, grabbed the metal with one hand, and tried to yank it down. It didn't want to come. Meanwhile, the dumpster rolled out from under him, leaving him dangling from the ladder by one hand. Jay grunted, caught the rung with his other hand, chinned himself up, and began to climb. It was at times like this he wished he could teleport himself as easily as he did his targets. But no, he had to do it the hard way. He hunkered down on the fire escape to catch his breath, sniffing dubiously at the air. Something smelled bad. All the lights were out in Sasha's loft. Jay moved stealthily along the fire escape toward the window. Climbing he could live without, but sneaking was his middle name. It was even easier when you didn't have to juggle a camera. The window opened on a bedroom. Jay took a quick peek, saw no one. He took out a glass cutter, carefully removed a section of the upper pane, and reached through to open the lock. When the glass came out, the smell got stronger. Jay eased open the window and climbed in, avoiding a window box where odd-looking herbs and flowers fought for space with weeds. It smelled foul inside the room. By then, Jay was pretty sure that he wouldn't be finding either Sasha or Azili at home, at least not alive. He moved quietly to the bedroom door, opened it a crack, listened for any sounds, heard none, and moved out into the hallway. The subdivided loft was a lot bigger than he'd supposed. There was the living room, the lavish kitchen, two baths, and six bedrooms. The closer he got to the back, the worse it smelled. When he opened the door to the back bathroom, he gagged and retreated. The dressing table in the adjoining bedroom offered a dozen different perfumes. Jay found a lace handkerchief in a drawer, doused it liberally, and held it over his mouth and nose. Then he went back to the bathroom to see who'd died. Streetlight poured wanly through a small frosted glass window onto the tile floor. Jay could see the tiny pale shapes of the maggots swarming over the corpse. Even through the handkerchief, the smell was overwhelming. Jay forced himself to turn on the lights. It was a child, a boy, he guessed, though there was barely enough left to tell. Bigger than the weird little monkey thing he chased through the dime museum, but way too small to be Sasha or Azili. Jay remembered seeing someone small and somehow misshapen run for the bedroom when Sasha had burst in on him and Azili. Maybe it was her kid. But would a mother just go off and leave her dead child's corpse to rot on the bathroom floor? The body was too far gone in putrefaction for close inspection. And the maggots reminded him unpleasantly of the white cone-faced thing in his dream. But he made himself stare at the decaying flesh. Definitely a joker. He was naked, and at first he seemed to have too many limbs, but Jay finally decided that the long swollen thing between his legs was a tail, The body lay face down, and Jay couldn't make out his features. But there was a huge open sore on the side of his neck, writhing with maggots. Jay had seen enough. He turned off the light, shut the door, and stood in the darkened hallway, considering his options. He could call the cops. Only this time, he wasn't there by invitation. This time he'd done a little breaking and entering. Jay decided he'd let somebody else claim the prize for once. He jammed the handkerchief back into his pocket and began to search the apartment. No one was home. No one had been home for some time. Except for the dead boy and the John, the tenants had cleared out in a hurry. Jay found open drawers where clothing had been pulled out and packed in a big rush. The furniture had been left behind, along with the strange Haitian shit that he had noticed on his last visit, but most of the personal effects had been removed. But not all. Enough remained to make Jay pretty damn certain that Azalee, Sasha, and the dead kid hadn't lived here alone. In one bedroom, he found a stack of weightlifting magazines beside the bare mattress on the floor, along with a set of barbells that showed signs of hard use. Somehow he couldn't imagine Sasha pumping iron. Another room had been sealed, its windows bricked shut, then fixed up like some kind of medieval torture chamber. Iron manacles hung from soundproof walls, and a long dissection table stood in the center of the room, with deep grooves for the runoff of blood. Behind the closet doors, Jay found a rolling instrument cart, carefully hung with knives, pliers, thumb screws, and other toys. Even an antique dentist's drill, its bit still crusted with dried blood. There were used syringes and scattered pills on the floor of a third bedroom, among beanbag chairs and throw pillows that reminded him of a hippie crash pad in the 60s. The linen closet had been turned into a wine cellar. Even Jay knew enough about wine to realize that Chateau Lafitte Rothschild cost a few bucks, and some of the other labels looked kind of pricey too. In the fridge, Jay found bottles of Dom Perignon, a can of beluga caviar, and other imported delicacies. Everything looked scrumptious, but somehow he wasn't very hungry. The hall closet was full of winter clothing that the tenants had forgotten in their haste. A linen jacket dangled from a hook inside the door, and the rack was crammed. There were women's coats in mink and Russian sable, and something spotted that was probably an endangered species, plus a leather aviator's jacket and some very expensive-looking items in cashmere, suede, and camel's hair, mixed right in with denim and polyester, men's stuff and women's stuff together, in a range of sizes that went all the way to the extremes. No gray-checked sport jackets with bullet tears in the shoulder, though. Jay looked. He was standing there contemplating the coats when the phone rang. A chill went through him. He remembered the funeral home, the strange call from the woman who spoke with Chrysalis's voice. No, he thought. Not this time. No one knows I'm here. Wrapping the damp, perfumed handkerchief around his hand, he picked up the receiver and held it to his ear.
"I've been calling all day. Where the hell you been?" a man's voice said. "I gotta have the kiss, you hear me? I need it. You don't know the kind of pressure I'm under here."
It all came out in one long, breathless rush. Only then did the speaker seem to realize that he hadn't heard a hello yet.
"Azalee, is it you?"
Jay spoke through the handkerchief and tried to disguise his voice.
"She's not here," he said. "Who's this?"
There was a moment of silence.
"Who am I talking to?"
the caller asked, in a sharp voice that was eerily familiar.
"Sasha,"
Jay said, trying to talk like Sasha.
"You're not Sasha,"
the man said. So much for that plan. Jay decided his best policy was to shut up and listen.
"Who is this?"
the caller demanded.
"You play games with me, you're in big trouble."
That did it. He knew the voice. All of a sudden, Jay was deeply grateful that he hadn't phoned the police. He dropped the receiver back into its cradle and got up fast. Kant could have a cruiser here in minutes. Jay had to move. He'd taken two steps when he noticed the message pad beside the phone. He went back. The top sheet had been ripped off, but he could still see the impressions on the sheet below. Two columns of numbers marched down the sheet in parallel, times. Jay pocketed the pad and retreated back to the fire escape. You didn't need to graduate with honors from detective school to figure this one out. Flight times. Sasha wasn't going to be coming to work anytime soon. And Jay had a funny hunch he knew what city the bartender had fled to. Thursday, July 21st, 1988. 1 a.m. You're taller, Jay said to Digger. Only a little. But when you start at 3 inches, an inch or two makes a difference.
Yeah.
Down said, from where he was perched in Oral Amy's lap.
The brat had to come in every morning before school and re-shrink the ones needed it most. Otherwise you grow.
Slowly, Jay said, locking the office door behind him.
Slowly, Digger admitted gloomily. Where the hell you been? I figured Hartman had gotten to you for sure.
Hartman's in Atlanta, Jay pointed out. I doubt he even knows I'm alive.
Don't bet on it,
the reporter said, his tone gloomy.
So what's going on? You blow the whistle?
No, Jay said. He went on into the back room, turned on the lights and the fan, sat down at his desk. Digger jumped down off Oral Amy and came trotting after him, his little feet pitter-pattering on the hardwood floor.
What the hell are you waiting for? An engraved invitation from the White House?
He said in an aggrieved voice.
They've started balloting down in Atlanta. Hartman could win the nomination while you're shuffling around picking your nose. You gonna let the guy who had Chrysalis killed become president?
Jay picked up the reporter by his collar. Do me a favor, Downs, and shut the fuck up, he said, dropping the little man in his wastebasket. Downs landed among the remains of the pizza and squawked in protest.
What the hell is wrong with you, Poppin' Jay?
I found another body, Jay told him.
Jesus, Digger said. Who?
Damned if I know.
Was it one of Mackey's?
Downs wanted to know. I don't think so, Jay said. This one was pretty ripe, but all the pieces were still attached. Downs climbed up the pizza box, teetered on the edge of the wastebasket for a moment, and jumped down to the floor. He landed with a grunt.
We got to get Hartman before he gets us, he said. I told you how he works.
Yeah, you told me, Jay admitted. It's a great story. It better be. It's all we've got. Your word against his. A presidential candidate versus the guy who broke the story about the Howler's secret love child. Wonder who they'll believe. Of course, you got substantiation. Chrysalis, Kahina, Gimli. Hell yes. Too bad they're all dead.
The jacket, Digger insisted. That's your proof.
Maybe, Jay admitted. If we had the jacket, which we don't, you wouldn't happen to know where Chrysalis hid her stash of secrets, would you? Downs shook his head. Too bad, Jay said. What can you tell me about Sasha?
Sasha, Digger looked thoughtful. Well, he's a telepath. Does that help? He just skims off surface thoughts, you know? But if he was to leak what he picked up... Christ, you don't think Sasha was tied with Hartman, do you?
The notion did cross my mind, Jay admitted.
Jesus,
Digger repeated.
I never paid much attention to Sasha. I mean, he was just kind of there, you know? But he was there a lot. If he was reporting to Hartman, she trusted him, goddammit. Him and Elmo... She counted on them. Sasha could pick up on trouble before it happened, and Elmo would handle it.
Unless Sasha was part of the trouble, Jay pointed out. Chrysalis ever say anything about Sasha's girlfriend? Digger seemed astonished.
What girlfriend?
Jay sighed. Never mind, he said.
He got up.
Where you going? Digger asked.
Out, Jay said.
When are you coming back?
Later, Jay said, as he unlocked the door. He needed a quiet drink. Some food would be nice, too. Not to mention sleep. But somehow, he didn't think sleep was part of tonight's program.
Brennan tossed and turned on the lumpy bed, half asleep and half awake, tormented by dreams that he couldn't separate from reality. He kicked off the confining sweat-soaked sheets and glanced over at Jennifer. She was still soundly asleep. The clock on the bedstand beside her said that he had about 2.5 hours before his meeting with Fadeout. He needed more sleep, but he doubted that it would come. The memory of Chrysalis was a dull ache in his mind. Like Tachyon had said, a ghost was a demanding one. He fantasized dropping the card she'd given him on the body of the man or woman, Ace or Joker, who killed her. The only problem was that he could only conjure a big blank spot for the identity of the murderer. It wasn't Bludgeon. It wasn't the Oddity. He couldn't really picture Quasiman in the role of cold-blooded killer. That left Worm and Doug Morkel as the final possibilities for McRoy's list. Worm, maybe. Morkel, who the hell knew? He turned again restlessly toward the window and froze. He wondered if he was still dreaming or if he was just hallucinating. The window seemed to have grown to gigantic proportions, lending credence to the notion that he was only dreaming that he was awake. It was framing Chrysalis from the neck up. He'd recognize her anywhere. It was her gleaming skull, her blue eyes, her red, pouting lips. He stared for a good 5 seconds, then closed and rubbed his eyes. When he opened them, she was gone. He lay there in bed, staring at the now empty window, telling himself to get up and go to it, but he was afraid. He lay there and closed his eyes and told himself that it was only a dream. And after a while, he'd almost convinced himself that that was true.
3 a.m.
Coffee, Jay?
Vi asked him. He grabbed a booth by the window. The counter drew a lot of strange people during the graveyard shift, and Jay wasn't feeling real sociable. Yeah, please, he said. And give me a patty melt, too. Extra onions, side of fries.
Gotcha.
Vi poured his coffee and left to place his order. Someone had left a rumpled Daily News in the booth. Jay smoothed it out and read the lead story. The Democrats had started voting down in Atlanta. Hartman had broken well in front, and he was gaining strength with each ballot. Leo Barnett was several hundred votes behind, followed by Jackson, Dukakis, and Gore. Much as he hated to admit it, Digger was right. He had to do something. But what? He pushed aside the newspaper, took his list from his pocket, and looked at the names again. Worm, Quasiman, Bludgeon, The Oddity, and Doug Morkel. Yeoman swore it wasn't Bludgeon. If the mystery player was really Hartman and not Barnett, that deep-sixed Quasiman's motive. Jay hadn't turned up a damn thing pointing at the Shadow Fists. And the M.O. was all wrong for Worm anyway. He still didn't know who the fuck Doug Morkel was. But by now, he didn't care. It had to be the Oddity, didn't it? Jay dug out the list of flight times. He'd swiped off the scratch pad by Azili's phone. He took a sip of coffee. Fuck it, he said aloud. It didn't have to be the Oddity. Atlanta was too damn close. It looked like the flight time averaged about 2 hours, nonstop. The earliest departure left at 6:55 in the morning and got into Atlanta at 9:07. The killer could have caught the last plane out of Atlanta Sunday night, dropped by the Crystal Palace in the early hours of the morning to murder Chrysalis, and still made it back to Georgia in time for the opening of the convention, which meant that some of the other names on the list deserved a second look. If Downs was telling the truth, Chrysalis had sent her assassin after Greg Hartman. She hadn't told anyone, yet somehow Hartman had found out. The leak had to be Sasha. Elmo had been hiring the assassin just about the same time Chrysalis was getting killed, which meant somebody had known what she was going to do before she did it.
New York had too many damn telepaths as far as Jay was concerned. But Sasha was the only one who was close to Chrysalis. Jay took a swallow of coffee, grimaced, and cursed himself for a fool. He should have seen it much earlier. Sasha had been there when Jay found the body. Even without eyes, he'd sensed an intruder in the building. So why hadn't he sensed the killer? Or had he? Okay, so Sasha picks the assassination plot out of Chrysalis's mind and leaks it to Hartman, who sends Mackie Messer to make sushi out of Digger Downs, and someone else. Someone with superhuman strength. To take Chrysalis out of the game. The Oddity? Maybe. But Jack Braun was a Hartman supporter, and Billy Ray was the senator's bodyguard. The brutality of the murder seemed out of character for Braun. Carnifex had a nasty reputation, but maybe that didn't matter. According to Downs, the Syrian girl claimed Hartman made her slit her brother's throat. So maybe he compelled Braun to do his dirty work the same way. Fi came bustling up with his patty melt in one hand and a fresh pot of coffee in the other. She set down the plate and refilled Jay's cup. He folded up his papers and put them away. "Who you like for president, Vi?" he asked the waitress. She snorted. "They're all crooks," she said as she walked off. "I wouldn't vote for none of them." Jay stared at his patty melt. The onions were grilled almost black, just the way he liked them. He tried a French fry. It needed ketchup. "Hey, Vi," he called out. But by then she was back behind the counter, waiting on a couple of hookers who just strolled in off 42nd Street. The Oddity was still a better candidate than Golden Boy or Carnifex, Jay decided. Hartman would have had to have learned of the assassination the night before to get either Braun or Ray on a plane on time. But if he had known that far in advance, why the hell did it take him so long to send Mackie after Digger Downs? And why not have Mackie take care of Chrysalis, too? Why use two killers, either of whom could implicate him? And why dispatch someone from Atlanta when he had local talent on the scene? That is, assuming Mackie had been on the scene. Maybe he'd been in Atlanta, too. That would explain why it had taken him so long to make his try for Downs. The hell of it was, if Hartman was an ace, every name on the goddamn list would need a second look. Troll, Ernie the Lizard, Doughboy. Hell, they were probably all Hartman fans. None of them seemed to have any particular motive for killing Chrysalis, but maybe they didn't need one. Maybe they were Hartman's unwilling pawns, like Kahina. So where the fuck did that leave him? Jay took a bite of his patty melt and chewed thoughtfully. Was Hartman a secret ace? Digger said so. Him and his goddamn nose. Some evidence. A smell that no one else could smell. The cops would just love that. The only way to prove Digger's story was to find that jacket. Jay tried to think where he might hide if he was a jacket. But the only thing that came to mind was a closet. And all the obvious closets had been checked pretty thoroughly. The patty melt needed ketchup, too.
"Vi?"
Jay called loudly. She came over with a coffee pot in hand and stopped when she saw his cup was still full.
"What you need, honey?"
"Ketchup," Jay said. Vi looked disgusted.
"Honest to Christ," she said. "What do you think that is?"
she pointed. Jay blinked. The ketchup bottle was right there on the table, over against the window between the napkin dispenser and the salt and pepper shakers. Vi gave a put-upon sigh and walked off. Jay picked up the bottle, unscrewed the top, and poured a good-sized puddle on his plate. How stupid could he get? The damn thing was right there in front of him, all the time. Then it hit him.
4 a.m. The forgotten cemetery, left unattended for several decades, had become a pocket wilderness in the city. Many of its graves collapsed during the years of neglect. Its weathered tombstones, most bearing names as forgotten as the cemetery itself, were canted crookedly throughout the rank undergrowth. The graveyard had an air of melancholy decay about it, but Brennan didn't mind. He liked its silent darkness. It was almost as quiet and peaceful as the country. He wore dark clothes and carried his compound bow, assembled and ready for use. The bow was the proper weapon for this place, stained as dark as the night that hid Brennan and as quiet as the corpses that kept him company as he waited. The silence was finally broken by the approach of a car that Brennan heard but couldn't see from his hiding place in the bushes. He could hear the driver park outside the crumbling brick wall that surrounded the graveyard and kill the engine. Doors opened and slammed shut, and there was silence again. Then Brennan heard something heavy move through the undergrowth. He froze. From the sounds it made, Brennan could tell that it was big. He took a deep breath, but could smell nothing besides the annoying city odors that penetrated even here. He stood still, holding his breath in a night so quiet that he could hear the blood rushing through the capillaries in his ears. He heard it move through the bushes and high grass, searching for him. He ran through the undergrowth, moving away from the thing as silently as he could. It paused and took a great snuffling breath as it tasted the air for his scent. He kept moving, circling around the deteriorating mausoleum, where once he'd ambushed a group of immaculate egrets who were using an alien teleportation device to smuggle heroin into the city. He paused a moment when he heard a vast, satisfied hissing, as if a dozen steam pipes had burst and were happy about it. The thing hunting him had found his trail. Faster now, careless of sound, Brennan bounded over the broken tombstones and through a tangle of lilac and wild rose, his way lit by a late-setting moon a few days short of full. He pushed through the undergrowth, ignoring the thorns that tore at him, and reached the base of the crumbling brick wall that surrounded the cemetery. There was a loud crash at his back as something long and sinuous smashed through the stand of lilac and wild rose and stood shining in the night, moonlight glistening off its silver and gold scales. It was a 20-foot-long dragon, slender as a snake. Its 4 feet bore razor-sharp talons. Its face was an elaborate oriental mask with knife-like teeth, bulging red eyes, and clouds of steam puffing from its flaring nostrils. It had to be Lazy Dragon. Fade-out had sent him to the meeting as something far removed from a mouse or a cute little kitty cat. Brennan automatically reached for the quiver velcroed to his belt, though he doubted that even his most powerful explosive arrow would harm such a formidable-looking beast.
The locks were nothing special. Caution made the job take 3 times as long as it should have, but finally he managed to slide back the deadbolt. Jay opened the door a crack and moved inside the cool, dark interior of the famous Bowery Wildcard Dime Museum. A red light blinked silently in the key box mounted on the wall. Jay went to it and punched in the sequence of numbers he'd seen Dutton enter on Tuesday night. He had a good memory for things like that. The flashing red light was replaced by a steady green. The interior of the museum was even creepier now that he was alone than it had been when Dutton had led him through it. The wax figures stared at him as he crept down the halls, and he kept imagining monstrous Joker babies lurking in every shadow. He got lost twice before he finally found the Syrian diorama. All the lights were out. Jay could barely make out the outlines of the wax figures behind the glass, each frozen in a moment of time. Saeed poised on the brink of collapse, Hiram squeezing his fists. Poor lost Kahina with the blood-stained knife in her hands. Somewhere in the middle was Hartman. It was too dark to see the senator clearly. There had to be some way inside. He looked over the row of special effects buttons, picked one, and pressed. Inside the diorama, hidden lights bathed Jack Braun in a golden glow. Long dusky shadows grew from the wax figures. The dim light stained Carnifex's white costume yellow as a dandelion, glittered off Peregrine's metal talons. Off to one side, barely visible against the painted backdrop, Jay saw the faint outline of a door. He released the button and looked around until he found a door marked Employees Only. The accessway was pitch black, airless, and narrow. Jay lit a match and fumbled his way along with one hand on the wall. the door to Syria was unlocked. Jay dropped the burnt-out match and lit another. Its reflected twin burned faintly in the dark glass, and the flame made the wax figures seem to twist and move. Jay stepped carefully over Dr. Tachyon, unconscious on the ground in his Arab finery, edged between Golden Boy and the Oddity, and passed under Saeed's awesome looming presence to where Greg Hartman stood. Hartman's tie was deftly knotted, his dress shirt pressed and starched. He was in his shirt sleeves. Jay blinked in confusion. Then he heard the soft footfall behind him. He turned just in time to see the huge black-cloaked figure looming over him, and glimpsed the fist whistling out of the darkness. The first blow nearly took his head off. The second smashed him square in the chest, and he stopped breathing. Somewhere in there, he lost the match. A fist like a cinder block caught him along the side of his head and knocked him sideways. Jay bumped into a wax terrorist and went down hard. It dawned on him, as he lay dazed, that the Oddity hadn't gone on that WHO tour. He didn't have to think about it long. Jay felt hands grab him, fingers like steel cable digging into his flesh. He was jerked upward, and then he was flying, glass shattered all around him, and something hard and cold came up to smash into him. He thought maybe it was the floor.
Brennan suddenly realized he was about to shoot at the wrong target. He swiveled, grabbed the top of the crumbling brick wall that surrounded the cemetery, and pulled himself up. Fadeout was leaning against the hood of the car parked in front of the cemetery gate, smoking a cigarette. Brennan scowled, grabbed an arrow, and raised his bow and fired. Fadeout did a double take as the arrow punched through the hood of his car, penetrating deep into the engine. "Jesus Christ!" He stared at the chef for a moment, turned, and looked into the night. "Yeoman?" "Call off Dragon," Brennan answered. "Or the next one goes into your right eye." Fadeout hesitated. "I mean it," Brennan shouted, calculating his chances of releasing the shaft he had knocked to his bowstring, finding an explosive arrow in his quiver, stringing it, and hitting the dragon before the beast pulped him. His fingers twitched, ready to release the arrow he had aimed to fade out. Then the Shadowfist captain called out,
"Okay, it's okay. I just wanted him to scout the cemetery. Dragon, go back to your body, now!"
Brennan stared at the creature. It looked back impassively, and then started to twist and shrivel, collapsing upon itself until it was only a small bit of intricately folded paper that blew away on the night wind. A moment passed, then Lazy Dragon got out of the back of the car and stood by Fadeout. Brennan relaxed the tension on his bowstring. "Come in through the gate," he called, "if you're done playing games and want to talk." Fadeout and Dragon exchanged glances. Fadeout was older, taller, a fit-looking man in an expensive-looking suit. Dragon was a young Asian, smaller, frailer-looking, but he had the more dangerous ace power of the two. Fadeout, though, was the boss, and Dragon would take his cue from him.
"You can't blame me for being cautious," Fadeout said, leading the way into the cemetery through the sagging wrought-iron gate. "You killed a lot of fists at Tachyon's clinic."
Brennan jumped down lightly from the top of the wall. "Do you really care about that?" he asked.
"No,"
Fadeout admitted. He looked around, suppressing a shiver.
"But I was, well, a little concerned about meeting in this godforsaken place. It gives me the creeps."
"I like it. Dark, quiet, plenty of cover." Brennan was suddenly tired of all the small talk. "Let's talk about Chrysalis." Fadeout glanced at Lazy Dragon, who was watching him passively.
"I know that you're looking for Chrysalis's murderer. You caused quite a scene at Swish's basement. I'm afraid that you totally ruined Bludgeon's reputation."
"It wasn't hard. It wasn't the same old Bludgeon." Fadeout nodded.
"He's dying of AIDS. That's not a fate I'd wish on anyone, but I can't say that I'm too sorry. The man was a disgusting brute. Now he's disgusting and pathetic."
"I didn't call this meeting to discuss Bludgeon's health problems."
"Right. I want to help."
"Help?"
"Yes. Help find Chrysalis's killer."
"I see." Brennan smoothed his mustache thoughtfully. "And in return?" Fadeout shrugged.
I want nothing more than you want. I want Qian removed.
Brennan smiled slowly.
I don't know what you have against him,
Fade Out continued,
but I know that you want him bad. As for me, well, let's say that I could envision the Shadow Fist doing quite nicely with a new leader.
Brennan glanced at Lazy Dragon. And a new chief lieutenant?
I'm very generous, Fade Out said, to those who help me. I've been generous to Lazy Dragon. I was generous to you in the past, and can be again.
The only thing I need, Brennan said, is information.
Ask away.
Did Worm kill Chrysalis?
Well, you cut right to the heart of the matter, don't you?
Fade Out said, shaking his head. That's right.
Well, Fade Out said carefully, we all know that Worm has a violent temper, and he's totally devoted to Qian. Chrysalis, of course, knew that Qian is head of the Fists, but she'd kept quiet about it. If, however, she found out something that threatened Qian, Worm might have had the initiative to do something on his own.
Like finding out about Qian's new designer drug?
Rapture,
Fade Out asked.
Yes, you've learned about our new head candy, haven't you?
Something about it.
Perhaps Chrysalis learned something about it, too.
And Worm killed her. Fade Out shrugged again.
I make no accusations. It's a thought, however. I can make a few discreet inquiries on the subject.
Brennan nodded. All right. I'll be in touch.
One thing,
Fade Out said as Brennan turned away.
You might keep your eyes open for Chrysalis's secret files.
Secret files?
Her information cache. The talk is that she kept meticulous records concerning everything she'd ever discovered on everybody in the city. And those records didn't turn up when the police searched the palace. And you can bet that the police had orders to search very thoroughly.
What do you want with these files? Fade Out smiled.
Someone has to take Chrysalis's place.
Brennan shook his head. You're an ambitious man. First you want to replace Qian, now you want to replace Chrysalis. Fade Out shrugged.
A man has to stay busy.
All right, Brennan said. I'll keep my eyes open for them. I may want to have a look at them myself.
Fine, Fade Out said with a smile. Have fun catching Chrysalis's killer. Then come after Qian. I'll be there to help you.
We'll see. Brennan turned, stopped, turned back to Fade Out and Lazy Dragon. One last thing. Ever hear of an ace named Doug Morkel? Fade Out and Dragon exchanged glances.
No. Should I have?
Beats me, Brennan admitted. He's on my list of suspects, but no one has ever heard of the bastard.
Morkel. Strange name. I'll ask around.
Brennan nodded, turned again, and faded into the night, leaving Fade Out and Dragon to deal with a car whose radiator fluid was now an oily green puddle on the street.
6 a.m. Jay opened his eyes and closed them again quickly. The light made his headache unbearable. The pounding behind his eyelids was like thunder. The left side of his face was a single dull mass of pain, and he could taste blood in his mouth. Somebody had yanked his hands behind his back and tied them together. When he tried to get up, something ground together inside his chest, and the pain was excruciating. A feeble groan escaped his lips. He rolled back and tried to lie very still. Maybe he should just go back to sleep.
I heard him,
a deep voice muttered, somewhere far away.
He moaned. He's coming to.
Bring him here, John, someone else said. The second voice was vaguely familiar. Massive hands lifted him, as easily as a grown man might lift a child, carried him across the room, and propped him up in a chair. The hands were not gentle. Jay had to stifle a scream. Open your eyes, Mr. Ackroyd, the second voice said. Reluctantly, Jay tried. His left eye was swollen almost shut. The Grim Reaper sat staring at him across an antique desk,
Dutton?
Jay managed through cracked, bloody lips. The Reaper nodded. A shadow fell across Jay. He forced himself to turn his head. It wasn't until you got really close to the oddity that you realized how big the fucker was. He could hear labored breathing from behind the fencing mask and feel the weight of eyes staring down implacably through the steel mesh.
You said you didn't know the oddity,
Jay said to Dutton. I lied, Dutton told him. Jay tried to think of a wisecrack, but his mind wasn't in it. He closed his eyes again, forced them open. He felt like his head was going to explode.
I don't, he said. Don't suppose you got any aspirin you could let me have?
John, Dutton said, there's a bottle of aspirin in my toilet. If you wouldn't mind.
Let him hurt, the oddity rumbled. He doesn't care how much we hurt, does he? Let him bleed for a while.
I understand the sentiment, Dutton replied. But we do want his cooperation after all. Please. Grumbling, the oddity shuffled through the bathroom door in the back of the office. Jay heard the medicine cabinet open with a bang, then the sound of water splashing into a sink. My apologies, Dutton said. John's temper often gets the better of him, and I'm afraid he does not like you. The oddity returned with a handful of aspirin tablets in one hand and a glass of water in the other. With his hand still tied behind his back, Jay could only open his mouth. The oddity stuffed in a half dozen aspirin, then lifted the water to his lips. Jay swallowed until he began choking. The oddity grunted, stood up, and watched Jay sputter for breath. The Joker's right hand, the one that held the water glass, was big and rough, coarse dark hair covering the knuckles. The left was much smaller, more delicate. A woman's hand, its fingernails long and pointed. Under the thick, dark clothing, Jay could see the swell of breasts.
Thanks,
he managed. Fuck you, the oddity snarled. Jay turned back to Dutton.
You knew I was coming, he said.
It wasn't a question. You or someone like you, Dutton replied. How much is Barnett paying you to betray your own people? For a moment, Jay didn't think he'd heard him right.
Barnett,
he said groggily.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Don't try my patience, Mr. Aykroyd, Dutton said wearily. Why do aces insist on treating jokers as though we were retarded children? I didn't get where I am by being stupid.
You may be the smartest guy in the world, for all I know, Jay said. But you're still wrong.
Am I? Dutton said. Then why are you here? Jay hesitated.
You know the jacket is the real McCoy.
Yes, Dutton regarded him from eyes deep sunk in that ghastly yellow face. Chrysalis hinted as much when she gave it to me to incorporate into our diorama.
The purloined letter, Jay said. Hide the goods in plain sight, where hundreds of tourists will see it every day and assume it's just a replica of itself. Not bad at all. Only she didn't tell you why she wanted it hidden, did she?
No, Dutton admitted. It did pique my curiosity. But I had learned not to press her. After her death, I got the whole story.
From us, the oddity put in. We told them, after you left, that night you led us here. You aces think jokers have shit for brains. But this time, the joke's on you.
Then you know about Hartman,
Jay asked Dutton.
That he's a wild card, Dutton said. What of it? He remains the last best hope we jokers have.
Yes, he hides his condition. In the present political climate, a sane man has no other choice. The public will never vote for a wild card,
Not even a latent like Hartman. Not when there's a chance the virus will express and turn him into one of us. That's why Leo Barnett wants the jacket.
I'm not working for Leo Barnett, Jay started.
Liar,
the oddity snarled.
You're taking his goddamn Nat money to help him destroy Greg.
You're wrong, Jay said. Hartman's a killer ace.
The oddity moved faster than Jay would ever have guessed, grabbing him by the hair, slamming his head back against the chair, and slapping him hard enough to rattle teeth.
Shut up! Greg's the only friend the Jokers have!
Jay had a mouthful of blood from his split lip. He spat it feebly at the fencing mask and called out to Dutton.
You just gonna sit there and watch the Holy Trinity here beat me into ground, Chuck? Or you want to hear me out?
Let him alone, John, Dutton said. I want to hear what he has to say. Reluctantly, the oddity let go of Jay's hair and stepped back, away from the chair. The Joker's massive body shuddered. The fingers of its left hand seemed to be thickening, and its breasts were shrinking visibly.
I don't even know Leo Barnett, Jay began.
You're an ace who sells his services for money. I doubt that Barnett hired you personally. Nonetheless, you're working in his interests. Why else would you want the jacket?
The jacket got Chrysalis murdered, Jay said. And I hate to mention this, especially when I'm sitting here trussed up like a Christmas goose. But this great Joker hero of yours is looking more and more like the one who did the trick.
That's not true, the oddity said. The voice was softer than before, gentler, unmistakably a woman's voice.
And now the left hand was the one that was blunt and calloused. The fingers of the right hand had grown longer and lost their hair, and the skin had turned a deep chocolate brown.
Why should we want to hurt Chrysalis?
Because Greg Hartman told you to. And you just love Senator Greg, don't you? Jay snapped.
Greg is a good man, the oddity said.
Jay thought the Joker sounded a little defensive. The oddity couldn't possibly have killed Chrysalis, Dutton said patiently. If you were a patron of the arts, Aykroyd, you'd know that Evan is a sculptor. Once he worked in clay, bronze, marble. These days, he sculpts in wax. But Patty and John lack the talent. So Evan can only work during the brief times when his mind and at least one of his hands emerge from the oddity. He seizes those moments when they come, day or night. Dutton sounded almost sad as he dropped the other shoe. Evan was right here during the murder, working on a new mistral for our gallery of beauty. What does that do to your theory? Jay was suddenly aware of the blinding pain behind his eyes again, and all he wanted to do was go home and be sick.
Shit, he managed.
Then Hartman must have sent someone else, Carnifex maybe, or Braun, or maybe this guy Doug Morkel, I don't know.
You're reaching, Aykroyd, Dutton said.
He looked over at the oddity.
Why don't you tell us what really happened, Patty?
The oddity turned toward Jay. Even the way the Joker moved seemed different now, subtly feminine.
No Joker would have hurt Chrysalis. She was one of us. The killer had to be working for Barnett, looking for the jacket. Maybe he was only trying to beat the secret out of Chrysalis, but he went too far.
The oddity sounded utterly sincere.
That's so, Jay said.
Mind telling me the guy's name?
There's no way to be certain, the oddity said, the woman's voice somehow eerie and frightening, coming from the huge, misshapen body. Perhaps Quasi-Man. He's a poor, simple-minded thing who does as he is told, and he owes his life to Reverend Barnett.
The oddity's right hand gestured daintily in the air. It was a man's hand. The nails bitten right down to the quick.
or perhaps some ace who sells himself for money the way you do.
You're telling me Chrysalis died to protect Hartman, because he's such a great friend of the Joker's, right?
Jay looked first at Dutton, then over at the oddity.
Then answer me this. If she was so fucking concerned about keeping Hartman's little secrets, why didn't she destroy the jacket a year ago?
The perpetual grin on Dutton's yellowed face pulled into a momentary grimace. That question troubled me as well, he said. But my partner's plans were often subtle, and her motives were sometimes obscure. No doubt she was playing some game.
That jacket was her life insurance, Jay said. Now that she's dead, it's time to cash in the policy.
Do you have any idea what's going on down in Atlanta? Dutton asked impatiently.
Thousands of Jokers have gone south to peacefully demonstrate in support of Hartman. They've been welcomed with arrests, street brawls, attacks by the Klan. Yesterday, there was a near riot when 100 men in Confederate uniforms fired on the crowd.
Barnett has already managed to pull the teeth out of our Joker's rights plank. And if he's elected, the good Reverend will put us all in camps. Many people believe that Greg Hartman is the only thing that stands between this country and Joker genocide.
A lot of people believed in Hitler, too, Jay said. Dutton sighed.
This conversation is as pointless as your quest, I'm afraid. You see, it really doesn't matter who you're working for, Mr. Aykroyd. You're too late. Much as I hated to damage a genuine historic artifact, too much was at stake to take any chances. Go back to your employers and tell them it's over. We burnt the jacket.
Ashes to ashes, the oddity said. You can't hurt Greg now.
The tainted blood is gone, Dutton told Jay. And if God is merciful, Greg Hartman is going to be the next president of the United States.
8 a.m. Squish's basement was still as crowded, still as dark, still as smelly as it was when Brennan had discovered it a few days before. The same bartender was behind the bar, and mostly the same customers were scattered about the room, though this time around Bludgeon was absent. A couple of the regulars greeted Brennan jovially, and one asked him if he was going to slap around another ace. Not today, Brennan said with a smile. Just a drink and a few words with a friend. Tripod was perched on the edge of a bar stool at the end of the bar, his pelvic arrangement making it impossible to sit on the chair in a normal manner.
What it'll be?
The mouthless bartender asked, his voice rasping from a small hole cut at the base of his throat. Irish whiskey, tell him more. The bartender continued to wipe glasses with a rag that Brennan wouldn't have used to wipe his nose. Brennan sighed. All right, scotch.
Scotch we got,
the bartender said, taking down the bottle of importers from the wall and pouring a shot. Squisher peered cautiously from his aquarium.
How's it going, big guy?
All right, Brennan said, pulling a roll of bills from his pocket and peeling off a five.
Hey, Squisher said, your money's no good here. Friends of Squisher drink for free.
Brennan nodded and put the money back in his pocket. Thanks, I remember that. Brennan took his drink and joined Tripod at the end of the bar, where he was sipping a mug of beer through a straw. The Joker asked, polite as always,
What's up, Mr. Y?
Anything new? Brennan asked quietly. Tripod pursed his lips.
Nothing, Mr. Y. I've been wearing my feet off, but Sasha's gone, man. He's lying low somewhere, and I can't find him.
Brennan nodded, took a sip from his drink. Something new has cropped up. It may be connected with the murder, but I'm not sure yet. You know anything about a drug called Rapture?
Oh, yeah, Tripod nodded. Very new, very chic. They say it makes everything feel real good, you know, better than ever. Food, sex, other drugs, even pain.
Pain?
Yeah, like some R-heads might take a razor blade to themselves because it feels so good.
It doesn't feel too good when they come down, though.
Brennan nodded. Maybe Chrysalis discovered something about the drug that led to her death. It had to be something big, something awful, not just knowledge that the drug existed.
You know, Tripod said thoughtfully, Sasha's girlfriend was a raphead. At least I seen her around with blue lips sometimes.
Girlfriend? Brennan said. Sasha had a girlfriend?
Yeah, you didn't know about her? She's a real hot babe by the name of Azili Rouge. But it's not as if she's real close to the blind boy. She's got lots of boyfriends. Girlfriends, too. I hear she's even real fond of puppy dogs and like that.
Brennan frowned. Is she a hooker?
Probably. She gets dough from somewhere, and she's got a lot of it.
Do you know where she lives?
Hey, she's not in my league. I've seen her around. Face of an angel gone bad. Weird red eyes and a body that'll tempt a saint to sin. I'd give a leg to get a piece. Of course, I got more legs than I know what to do with anyway.
What about the police? Was she ever mixed up with them? Tripod shrugged.
Maybe. She spent a bundle on drugs. You gotta figure the police have been at least interested.
What kind of drugs?
You name it. She bought it. H, crack, coke, speed, lewds, pot, PKD, dust, designer stuff like Rapture. Christ! If the rumors are half true, she's bought enough dope to send an army up the highway to heaven.
Brennan frowned. Perhaps Sasha had gotten hooked on something that had put him under Azili's control. Perhaps he'd let slip something to Azili, who told Quincy, who told Worm. Perhaps, perhaps, perhaps. Where does she hang out?
Couple places.
Tripod gave him the names of some clubs, none of which had savory reputations. Brennan finished his drink, put the glass down on the bar, and surreptitiously dropped 2 20s on the floor. Thanks. He turned to leave, stopped, looked back at Tripod, who was slipping the bills into his ankle pocket with the oddly articulated toes of his middle foot. One last thing. Ever hear of an ace named Doug Merkel?
Merkel? What the hell kind of name is that for an ace?
Brennan shook his head. Damned if I know.
The back half of Dr. Finn looked like a Palomino pony. The front half looked too young to be a doctor. What happened? Finn asked as he taped up Jay's ribs. I was looking for a sport jacket, Jay said morosely. Remind me never to use your tailor, Finn replied. He finished the taping. There, how's that feel? Tight, Jay complained. He tried to flex his arm and winced at the pain. Makes it hard to move. Good, Finn said. I wouldn't want you doing too much moving until that rib knits. You're very lucky, Mr. Aykroyd. A few more inches, and that bone might have punctured a lung. What about my head? The x-rays show only a very mild concussion, Finn told him. Nothing to worry about, as long as you take it easy. Might as well, Jay said. Can't dance. Too bad, Finn said. He grinned and did a quick little four-legged soft shoe. I cut quite a rug myself. I'll just bet. Do I get anything for the pain? This headache would be killing me if I wasn't so distracted by my rib. Finn took a pad out of his pocket and scrawled a prescription. Here, he said, ripping off the top sheet and handing it to Jay. This ought to help. Thanks. Jay hopped down off the examination table. It was a mistake, and the broken rib let him know that right away. Oh, shit, he said, gritting his teeth. Don't want to go around jarring yourself that way, Finn said. Altogether too cheerfully for Jay's taste. I wouldn't drive in your condition either. You ever ride home? I'll take a cab, Jay said. Charles Dutton had taken him to the clinic after he'd satisfied himself that Jay had nothing more of value to tell him. But he didn't imagine that the Joker had hung around in the waiting room. Even if he had, Jay figured he'd had more than enough of Dutton and the oddity for today. You did the autopsy on Chrysalis, didn't you? He asked. Yes, Finn replied. The police always call us in on Joker autopsies. The coroner doesn't feel qualified to deal with our unique Joker physiology. The little centaur looked away and shuffled his feet uncomfortably. A terrible thing. We see a lot of murder victims here in the clinic, and it's never pretty. But the way her body was mutilated... Finn shook his head. Yeah. Jay touched his bruised and swollen face, thinking that he knew just how she must have felt.
5 p.m. Brennan awoke still soaked with sweat and numb from a half-remembered dream in which all his friends and lovers were killed, slowly and excruciatingly, by some unseen agency he was powerless to stop. He was reassured somewhat when he spotted Jennifer sitting in the room's only chair, listening distractedly to the transmitter they planted on Quasiman. She heard Brennan stir, turned to watch him sit up, and run his hands through his hair.
"About time you woke up," she said. "I'm suffering from terminal boredom listening to Quasiman stumble through his day."
"Nothing to link him to the murder?" She shook her head.
"Either he's incredibly clever, which frankly I doubt, or he has no connection with Barnett's crowd."
"What did he do today?" Brennan asked.
"Got up early. It took him a while to figure out how to use the mop. Then he washed the church's floors. Went up on the roof for a coffee break and forgot to come down. Father Squeak called up to him to remind him to mow the lawn in the graveyard. That was a tough one. By the time he figured out the lawnmower, it was lunch. He spent the afternoon mowing and trimming. Once the transmitter stopped sending for 45 minutes. I think it accompanied Quasiman into whatever alien dimension it is that he slips into. You ask me, he's just what he appears to be, a sweet, terribly afflicted church handyman."
"Figures." Brennan picked up his jeans off the floor and slid into them, then rummaged through the bureau for a fresh T-shirt. "I got a possible line on Sasha this morning from Tripod. It seems he is a girlfriend." He stopped and stared at the plain white envelope that was lying on the worn carpet just inside the door to the hotel room. "How long has that been there?" he asked Jennifer. She turned, looked at the envelope, and frowned.
"I don't know. I didn't notice it before."
Brennan crossed the room and picked up the envelope. It was unsealed and unaddressed. He opened it and took out the single piece of paper it held, with a message scrawled in a familiar childish hand. "Sorry how things turned out before," it read. "I only want to help you. If you find a real raphead, go to Chickadee's." "Damn," Brennan muttered to himself. "Just what the hell is going on here?"
6 p.m.
"Jesus," Digger said. "What's wrong with your face?"
Jay closed the office door behind him and looked down at the reporter. Digger was almost 8 inches tall now. In a couple more days, he might be able to pass for a dwarf. "I'm disguised as a guy who got the shit beat out of him," he said. He moved slowly across the office and sat down. The radio was babbling something about the convention. It made his head hurt even more. He turned it off.
"God, it hurts just to look at you," Digger said. "You realize that half your face is purple?"
"Good thing I don't wear a tie. The colors might clash."
"Don't worry about it. In a day or two, the swelling will go down and the bruise will turn green."
Down sounded like a man who'd been there himself. Sometimes the public didn't appreciate crusading journalists.
"Where the hell you been?"
"Sleeping," Jay said. The painkillers made him groggy.
"Sleeping? Jesus, Aykroyd! All hell is breaking loose down in Atlanta. Hartman's something like 300 votes from the nomination, and you decide to take a nap?"
"Downs," Jay warned. "I just woke up. My head feels like it's stuffed with cotton. I've got a concussion and a broken rib, but I don't dare take any more painkillers because I can't think straight when I do. And I lost the goddamn jacket, so if you don't shut the fuck up right now, I'm going to pop you to the middle of the Holland Tunnel to play in traffic, okay?"
Digger made a noise like a man whose aged grandmother had just been run over by a semi.
"You lost the jacket?" he screeched.
Jay sighed. "Dutton destroyed the damn thing before I could get to it," he said wearily.
"Jesus,"
Digger said in his irritating little voice in a panic.
"Jesus, Jesus, Jesus, what are we going to do?"
"We're running out of options," Jay admitted. "Not to mention time," he tried to think. It wasn't easy, the way his head was pounding. Look, maybe Kahina had something else beside the jacket. Blood tests, letters, anything.
I know it's a long shot, but what else is there? How much do you know about her?
I did a little digging after she died,
Digger said.
Very low-key, you know. I didn't want to stir nothing up. The chick was in the country illegally. I know that much. With her background, I didn't think it was likely she smuggled herself in, so she must have had help. But whoever did it was a pro. Covered up her trail real nice.
What about after she got here? Digger shrugged.
She was living in Jokertown under an assumed name. You should have seen where she was staying. A real dump. The girl had guts. I'll give her that, but it wasn't like she knew what she was doing. She couldn't have been more conspicuous if she tried. The day she arrived, she was even wearing one of them black Muslim things. You know, what you call it? A chatter. She switched to American clothes pretty quick, but it didn't help much. She was still the only gnat in the hotel, and it was obvious she just loathed jokers.
Then what the hell was she doing working with Gimli and Chrysalis? Jay said bluntly.
She wasn't working with Chrysalis, Digger said. That was Gimli's idea. Kahina was against it all the way. They had some huge fight about it. They fought all the time. Religion, politics, strategy. They didn't agree on anything.
He shrugged.
Hey, politics makes strange bedfellows, right?
Jay frowned. How do you know all this?
Chrysalis told me, Digger admitted. Gimli had a leak in his little conspiracy, and you know how it was. If anything leaked anywhere in Jokertown, you could bet your sweet ass that Chrysalis would hear it.
Yeah, said Jay thoughtfully. He got slowly to his feet.
Where are you going now? Digger asked.
Jokertown, Jay said. I got an urge to see Kahina's last known address for myself.
7 p.m. Brennan looked around Chickadees helplessly, wondering what to do now that he was here, alone. Jennifer was waiting for him outside, this not being the type of club where she could go and not attract attention. He went up to the bar and ordered a Tullamore. He was nursing it silently, letting thoughts crawl lazily, fruitlessly through his mind, when a slurred, drunken voice said,
"You're the one who was my little girl's friend."
Glanced down annoyedly, did a double-take and stared. The man who had spoken looked like Joe Jory. But he had been changed. His chin was virtually gone. His nose had been turned into a pig snout, and 2-inch-long incisors protruded from his helplessly grinning mouth. His eyes were beady and red, as if he'd been drinking or weeping for hours.
"What happened?" Brennan asked.
Jory gave a helpless shrug, as if nothing mattered anymore.
"I don't know. I went to a bar last night. It was in an alley, and a doorman was dressed all in black. He smiled a real strange smile and let me in for nothing. He said nothing at all. I told some of the people inside about my little girl, about how beautiful she'd been and what the virus done to her, and they brought me drinks and told me how sorry they were that my child was a joker, and they told me to tell everyone about it. I got up on the stage and told everyone how awful it was, how we didn't have jokers in Oklahoma, and people laughed at me. They laughed, and someone yelled, 'You do now?' And this ugly bouncer threw me out of the bar. I went to another place, and people still laughed at me, and I realized that something horrible had happened, like someone put a mask on my face, but I couldn't take it off. I drank till I passed out, and in the morning, I went back to the bar to make them turn my face back so I could be a real person again. But the bar was gone. It wasn't there.'
His voice ran down into racking sobs, and despite himself, Brennan was touched with pity for the bewildered man who was so far out of his depth. He'd run into a place Brennan had only heard whispers of, Joker's Wild in Rat's Alley, where the dead men lose their bones, where no one who enters is safe. But most anyone who enters is changed, never for the better.
"Help me," Jory sobbed.
"What do you want from me?" Brennan asked quietly.
"Give me my face back,"
Jory asked, but Brennan shook his head. "Can't do that," he said in the same soft voice.
"Then buy me a bottle. They took all my money last night, all my money and my face."
Brennan stared at him a moment longer, then signaled the bartender and put a 20 on the counter. When the bottle came, Jory took it and clutched it to his chest and scurried away. Brennan watched him disappear into the crowded room. It was then that he saw the girl with the blue mouth. She was with a man down the bar, drinking with him and laughing a little too loudly whenever he spoke. She was standing so close to him that her bare knees were pressing against his thigh, and she was toying with his hair, making little loose ringlets of it with her middle finger. Brennan thought she looked familiar, then realized that she was Laurie, the hostess who escorted him to Quinn's suite the night the Eskimo was having his coming-out party for Rapture. She was one of the demonstrators who had shown how safe and easy it was to take the drug. Brennan took his Tullamores and moved off down the bar. He stopped before the man, crowding him so that he had to look up. He smiled down at him. "I'd like to talk to the lady." The man looked as if he was going to dispute things, then thought better of it. "Sure, buddy," he said. "Plenty of babes in this place." He slid off the stool, and Brennan took his place. Laurie watched the John hurry off, then switched her attention to Brennan. She smiled. Her blue gums and tongue made her smile look sinister against her white teeth and red lips.
"You look like a man who likes to party," she said hopefully.
She obviously didn't recognize Brennan, which was perfectly understandable since he'd been wearing a Mae West mask the last time she saw him. "I do."
"Good."
Her smile grew wider, her eyes brighter.
"Let's go upstairs, honey. I can show you something you've never seen before."
"You can?"
"Sure. Trust me."
She urged Brennan off the stool. Her palms were sweaty. Her body had a vaguely sour odor about it, an odor of perspiration drowned in cheap body scent. Her room was a small cubicle with a messily made bed. She closed the door after them and smiled with insincere coyness at Brennan.
"Let's get the business out of the way, honey. Then we can be friends. Now,"
she went on after Brennan had nodded,
"it's going to cost $100, but for only $150, I can give you something really special, something really different."
"What's that?" Brennan asked. She was already pulling open the drawer of a cluttered, rickety vanity.
"It's called Rapture, honey, and it's sheer heaven."
She held up a small vial of blue powder, much like the one Brennan had seen the night of the party. But as soon as she drew it out, she became fixated on it. She stared at it with growing blankness, and her hands began to shake a little. She unstoppered it and stared at it like it held the keys to the kingdom. "What's it do?" Brennan asked, watching her closely.
"Do?"
As if unable to resist any longer, she dipped her forefinger into the vial, then put it into her mouth, rubbing it swiftly across her already stained gums. She smiled and sucked her now blue fingertip daintily, as if it had been dipped in some sort of delicious sauce.
"It makes everything so fresh and tasty and good-feeling. Let me rub a little on your cock, honey, and it will be out of this world."
"Is it dangerous?" Laurie laughed and shook her head.
"No way. I've been taking it for weeks now."
She leaned closer and smiled confidentially.
"Me and the guy who made it are like this,"
she said, entwining two fingers. "I'll bet." Brennan moved closer, and she smiled in unfocused ecstasy, her hand dropping to the crotch of his jeans and fumbling there. He smiled at her. "No thanks," he said, and smoothly took the vial of Rapture away from her.
"Hey!"
"Why can't we do it without the Rapture?" he asked.
"Because it's so good with it."
"I like it plain."
"But it's better, it really is,"
she said with increasing frenzy. He remembered what Quincy had said about it a couple of days before, a drug that was so good that it makes a whore like sex. "What's it like without the Rapture?" he asked, holding the vial away as she snatched for it.
"Like always," she spat. "Boring, dead, unfeeling."
"How about food? What's that like without a dose?" She made a face.
"Cardboard and paste, rotting compost."
"Wine? Champagne?"
"Tepid water with shit floating in it. Give me that."
Brennan held it up away from her, shaking his head. "I need it. I have a friend who might want to have a look at this."
"I'll scream," she said.
Brennan shook his head. "No, you won't. I'm going to give you a dose. Then I'm going to tie you up, and you can tell everyone that I robbed you."
"Give me two doses. One for later," she panted.
"Sure." Laurie nodded frantically and turned back to her vanity. She gave Brennan a small tin box, into which he tipped a shot of the powder. Then she handed him a small mirror. He laid out a line, and she found a straw somewhere, and took it all in through her nose with a long snort. She leaned back and smiled. "What's it like when you do it that way?" he asked curiously.
good thoughts, Laurie said dreamily. Only good thoughts.
He nodded and led her to the bed. She sat down obediently as he tore the sheet into strips, bound and gagged her. He left the room wondering what kind of thoughts she'd have after the rapture wore off.
10 p.m. Digger Downs had been right about one thing. The hotel where Kahina had spent her final weeks was a real pit. A half-dozen elderly jokers sat in the lobby, watching an ancient black-and-white Philco while they waited to die. When Jay entered, they all looked at him with dim, incurious eyes. No one spoke. The jokers, like the lobby, smelled of decay. The night clerk was a stout woman in her 60s, with her hair worn in a bun. Her breath smelled of gin, and she didn't know nothing about no Arab girl. But she was perfectly willing to let Jay have a look at the files once he'd slipped her a 10. The records were in just as shitty a shape as the rest of the building, but after 30 minutes with the registration cards and receipt books from May and June of 1987, Jay found what he was looking for. She'd paid 2 months in advance, in cash, for a room on the third floor. Less than 3 weeks later, the same room had been rented to someone listed only as Stig. Jay showed the cards and the receipt book to the night clerk. Her, he said, pointing out the name. The corner of a $10 bill was just visible under the registration card. It did wonders for the old woman's memory.
Oh, yeah. She was the pretty one. I only saw her once or twice. Thought she looked kind of Jewish. You mean she was an Arab?
A Syrian, Jay said. What happened to her? The woman shrugged.
They come, they go.
Who's this Stig? Jay asked.
Stigmata,
the old woman said. She made a face.
Disgusting. Makes me sick just to look at him. But Joe, he says even jokers need a place to stay. If it was up to me, honestly, these people are like animals. Anyway, Stig didn't pay his rent, and Joe evicted him. Good riddance to bad rubbish. And we rented his room to the Arab girl. But then a few weeks later, Stig had the money he owed us, and he says he wants his room back. We hadn't seen that girl for a week or so we let him back in.
Did the woman leave any personal effects?
Personal what?
Any stuff, Jay said impatiently. Letters, papers, a passport, luggage, clothing. She just up and vanished one day, right? What did you find when you cleared out her room? The night clerk licked her lower lip.
Yeah. Then I think about it. She had some stuff.
She studied him greedily.
You family?
I don't think I can give you her stuff unless you're family.
Wouldn't be right.
Of course not, Jay said. But it so happens that Mr. Jackson is a very close relative of hers.
Huh? She said,
eyes blank with confusion. Jay sighed a deep, put-upon sigh. How about I give you $20 for her stuff? He said wearily. That she understood at once. She took a key off the pegboard behind her and led Jay down to a damp, chilly basement. A dozen cardboard boxes were stacked unevenly behind the water heater, each marked with a room number. The boxes on the bottom were green with fungus and half-collapsed, their numbers all but illegible. But Kahina's legacy was on top. He went through the carton in a deserted corner of the lobby. There wasn't much. An English language edition of the Quran, a street map of Manhattan, a paperback copy of The Making of the President 1976 with the chapters on Greg Hartman dog-eared and underlined, some odd bits of clothing, a box of Tampax. Jay sorted through it twice and then carried the carton back to the desk. Where's the rest of it?
That's it. Ain't no more.
Jay slammed the carton down on the desk hard. The woman jumped, and Jay winced as his broken rib made him pay the price for the gesture. You got $40 of my money, and all I've got is a box of trash.
You're telling me this woman flew in from Syria with nothing but a few tampons and a U-Haul box? Give me a fucking break. Where's her luggage? Where's her clothing? Did she have any cash, any jewelry, a wallet, a passport, anything? Nothing, the old woman said. Just what's in the box. That's all we found. These jokers, they don't take care of their things like you and me. The way they live, it's disgusting. Show me your room. Her eyes narrowed. What's in it for me? That did it. Jay shaped his fingers into a gun and pointed. Ta-ta, he said, popping her away to the runway at Freakers. Thursday night was all-nude female joker mud wrestling. He hoped she was in better shape than she looked. The soft pop of her disappearance made a few of the jokers across the lobby look up. If they wondered what Jay was doing behind the desk, rummaging among the keys, they didn't wonder enough to do anything about it. Of course, there was no elevator in the building. Jay trudged up 3 flights of stairs, grateful that it wasn't 5, and then up and down the poorly lit hallway until he found the right door. His head was pounding and his side hurt like a son of a bitch. There was light flooding through the transom, he saw, and the noise of a television from within. Jay was in a rotten mood by then. He didn't bother knocking. When he pushed the door open, the room's lone resident jumped off the bed in alarm. What do you want? It was suffocating hot in the room, with no hint of a breeze coming through the open window. The gaunt, wasted-looking joker was dressed in a pair of gray jockey shorts that might have once been white. A black rag was knotted around his temple like a crude bandage. The palms of his hands were wrapped in black, too. So were the soles of his feet, wider strips of black cloth, wound round and round his abdomen. The bandages were crusty with dried blood. There were more clots in his thinning hair, and a red-brown stain on the front of his jockey shorts. Jay felt his anger drain away from him. I need to ask you a few questions, Stig, he said. Stigmata looked at him warily. Questions? That's all? When Jay nodded, the Joker seemed to relax. He edged over toward his television. It was a big new color Sony. Stigmata turned down the sound, but kept the picture on. On the screen, a man was falling, arms and legs wheeling as he plummeted down, past floor after floor, in the vast interior atrium of some building. A golden light played around him as he fell. Jay stared. That's Jack Braun, he said. Uninvited, he sat down on the edge of the bed. There was an assassin, Stig volunteered, almost eagerly. Didn't you hear? It was on all the channels. Some ace pitched a weenie right off the balcony. Jay went cold. Golden Boy was the nearest thing there was to an invincible ace. But a fall from that height? Is he dead? Dan Rather said the fat guy saved him. Made him light. Hiram. Jay breathed a sigh of relief. Hiram and his gravity power. Jay had been there the night the astronomer had flung Water Lily from the top of the Empire State Building. Hiram had saved her life by making her lighter than air. Now it looked like he'd done it again. The assassin, Jay began. He was like a buzzsaw. I bet he was after Hartman. The Joker's voice was bitter. They won't let him win. Just you wait and see. It'll be Barnett. Or one of them other fuckers. I wish they would all just eat shit and die. They don't care about us. Just talking about it got him angry. What do you want, anyway? He demanded. You got no call just walking in here. You gnats think you can just walk in any place. This is my room. I know it is, Jay said placatingly. Look, I need to know a few things about the woman who had the room before you. Stig didn't give him a chance to finish. It was my room first, he interrupted. They kicked me out. Just because I got a few months behind. 9 years I was here. And they just kicked me out and give my room away. Welfare was the one screwed up. It wasn't my fault. I didn't have the money. They kicked me out of my own room and locked up my stuff. Where was I going to go? The woman, Jay said.
trying to get him off the world's injustice and back on Kahina. Do you know who she was? Stigmata sat on the bed and examined one of his hands, picking at the black bloodstained fabric. She was one of us. She didn't look like a Joker, but she was. She had fits. I saw one. He looked at Jay. What happened to her? He asked. She was murdered, Jay said. Stig averted his eyes. Another dead Joker, he said. Scrawny fingers toyed with the bandage across his palm, scratching away the dried blood. Who cares about another dead Joker? What happened to her things? Jay asked. The Joker's eyes flicked up nervously, met Jay's, looked away again. Ask downstairs. They took it, I bet. They locked up my stuff. 9 years, and they lock me out and take my stuff. It's not right. All the while, his fingers played at his scabs. You're kind of nervous, aren't you? Jay asked. Stigmata jumped up. I am not, he said. I don't have to answer these questions. Who do you think you are? This is Joker Town. You stinking gnats don't have no business here. Jay was looking at his hands, at the bandages, plain cotton, dyed black, torn in ragged strips to bind his wounds. I'm not a gnat, he said, putting a little ice in his voice. I'm an ace, Stiggy. He made a gun with his fingers. Pink droplets of moisture ran down Stigmata's forehead. Blood mingled in with his sweat. I didn't do nothing, the Joker said. But his voice cracked in mid-sentence. That's a nice TV, Jay said. On the screen was a police composite of the suspected assassin. A scrawny teenage hunchback dressed in leather. How'd you pay for that TV, Stig? Looks kind of expensive. Where'd you get the money to pay your back rent, Stig? Stigmata opened and closed his mouth. The cheapskates who own this dump never change the locks, do they? Jay said quietly. The look in Stig's eyes was all the confirmation he needed. The Joker backed away from him. Some aces could shoot fire from their hands, toss bolts of lightning, spray acid. Stigmata had no way of knowing what Jay's finger could do. She was gone, he pleaded. I never heard her. Please, mister, it's the truth. No, Jay said. You didn't hurt her. You just robbed her. You still had your key, so after she was dead, you just came in here and helped yourself. She must have had a nice chunk of cash, enough to pay off your back rent and buy you a new television set, at least. What else did she leave? Luggage? Jewelry? What? Stigmata didn't answer. Jay smiled, aimed, and pulled back his thumb like a hammer. No, no jewels, Stigmata said, as beads of blood left pink trails down his forehead. Just her luggage and a bunch of clothes, that's all. Honest, it's the truth, please. Where is it? Jay asked. I sold it, Stigmata said. It was all girls' clothes. It wasn't no good to me. I sold it. The suitcases, too. It was the answer Jay had expected. Yeah, he said, disgusted. Figures. You sold it. Except for the chatters. Not much market for used chatters in Jokertown, right? So you kept those. He pointed at the Joker's hands. She must have had quite a few, if you're still ripping them up for bandages a year later. Stigmata gave a tiny guilty nod. Jay sighed and put his hands in his pocket. You're not going to hurt me? Stig said. Nothing I could do would hurt you any more than the wild card has done already, Jay told him. You poor, sad, sorry son of a bitch. He turned to leave. He actually had his hand on the doorknob when the Joker, out of some strange sense of relief and gratitude, said, It's one other thing. You can have it if you want. They wouldn't give me nothing for it at the Goodwill. Jay turned back. What? He said impatiently. A sport jacket, Stig said. But I don't think it's your size. Anyhow, it's no good. It's got a tear in the shoulder and someone got blood on it. Blood? Jay said. Stigmata must have thought he was angry. It wasn't me, he added quickly. Jay could have kissed him.
11 p.m. Mazurek paused halfway into his apartment with his hands still on the light switch, glancing around his dark living room with the tightly wired instincts of the hunter. "Hope you don't mind me just dropping in like this," Brennan said from the sofa. "But it's time to trade info again." Mazurek flicked on the light and snorted. "I don't see you for almost 15 years. Now I can't get rid of you." "I've got something you want to hear. I guarantee it." Mazurek sighed, shook his head, closed the door behind him, and stood with his back to it. "All right," he said. "I'll bite." Brennan looked at him closely. His mood seemed dark and somber, even for Mazurek. His eyes were sunken, and there were dark circles under them. The investigation into Chrysalis's murder, Brennan guessed, probably wasn't going very well. "Ever hear of a woman named Izili Rouge?"
"Izili Rouge? What's she got to do with anything?"
"So you've heard of her? Got an address?"
"What am I, the telephone book?"
"Well, do you know anything about her? Is she clean?"
"Clean? Christ, I guess so. Other than the fact that every man who sees her wants to hump her, and most do, from what I hear. She's clean as a goddamn driven snow."
"You sure?" Brennan asked.
"Yes, I'm sure," Mazurek grumbled. "We checked her out when she first made the scene. The boys drew straws for the privilege. And she checked out clean."
"Someone reliable do the checking?"
"Of course, my partner can't."
Pure as the driven snow, Brennan thought. That's not exactly what Tripod had told him. Something here didn't add up. Can't either wasn't as good a cop as Mazurek thought, or wasn't as trustworthy.
"All right," Mazurek grumbled. "What's this big thing I'm supposed to be getting all excited about?"
Brennan reached into the pocket of his denim jacket and tossed Mazurek the vial of rapture he'd taken from Laurie. "Know what that is?" Mazurek grunted.
"From its pretty blue color, I'd say it's that new designer drug that hit the streets this week. Most of the other samples we managed to score have been impure, cut with everything from dry milk to strychnine.
You know that it enhances sensation, food, drink, sex. It's supposed to turn near anything into an ecstatic experience."
"Yeah, we know all that."
"What you don't know about is a side effect," Brennan said. "After you take that stuff for a couple of weeks, you need it. You really need it. Anything without it, food, sex, whatever, is tasteless and sensationless, or worse, actually revolting." Mazurek sighed and sank back into his chair.
"So it quickly becomes addictive."
"Horribly addictive. You can confirm this with a girl at Chickadee's named Laurie. She's easy to spot. She got a blue mouth from taking this shit. Apparently she's been one of Quincy's human guinea pigs, so she's been at it longer than most."
"How long before this addiction takes root?"
Brennan shrugged. "I don't know. A few weeks, maybe."
"Well, this is valuable news. Makes what I have to do more difficult."
Mazurek locked eyes with Brennan, who returned the stare with a frown. "What's that, Mazurek?" The cop sighed and shook his head.
"You couldn't leave things well enough alone. You couldn't stay retired, could you? You had to come back and play vigilante again."
Brennan had a sudden sharp inspiration. "Aykroyd told you that I'm yeoman." Mazurek nodded.
"I should have guessed after our first conversation. I suppose I halfway did, but I didn't want to think it through. Then that damn PI rubbed our noses in it. Now we have to take you in."
"No, you don't," Brennan said quietly.
"It's my job," Mazurek said. "I'm sure you can appreciate that."
Brennan nodded. "I appreciate the fact that you have duties. I hope you realize that I do, too." Mazurek stood up straight, away from the door. "Let's not get into that," he said. Jennifer ghosted out of the wall next to Mazurek, quiet as smoke, and put the barrel of a suddenly solid pistol against his head. Mazurek froze and stared at her from the corner of his eye.
"The accomplice?"
he asked, his hands held out from his sides. Brennan got up from the sofa. "I learned the value of backup in Nam," he told Mazurek. "Something I haven't forgotten." He walked by the cop and opened the door.
"We'll be looking for you now," Mazurek told him.
"Your time will be better spent finding Chrysalis's killer and stopping the rapture trade," Brennan said as he went out the door. As the door slammed behind him, Mazurek whirled, grabbing the barrel of the gun. Wraith surrendered it with a laugh. He tried to grab her too, but she was already smoke, drifting through the wall on an unseen, unfelt wind. Friday, July 22nd, 1988. 6 a.m. Brennan was already awake and sitting in the chair by the bed when Jennifer turned and, finding him gone, woke up. She yawned and mumbled something sleepily. "Good morning," Brennan said, leaning over and kissing her on the forehead as she rubbed the sleep from her eyes.
"Is it morning?"
"Just about."
"Need a shower,"
Jennifer said, sitting up, still half wrapped in the twisted sheet.
"Care to join me?"
"Sure." Brennan still felt tired, too, and already sticky with sweat despite the earliness of the hour. "Go ahead. I have to make a quick phone call."
"All right."
She stood and shed the sheet.
"If you hurry, I'll soap your favorite parts."
Brennan smiled, reached for the phone, and dialed a number given him by a cat as Jennifer walked naked to the bathroom. The phone rang three times before it was picked up, and an annoyed voice said,
"Yes?"
"This is Yeoman."
"Christ, do you know what time it is?"
"It's early," Brennan said, cutting through fade-outs grumbling. "You said you'd help, and I need some information."
"All right, all right."
Fade-out was obviously still annoyed, but asked grumpily,
"What is it?"
"Do you know anything about a Joker cop named Kant?"
"Oh, him. Worm's evil twin."
"What?"
"Nothing. A joke. They both look like they escaped from the reptile house. What do you want to know about him?"
"Is he honest?"
"Well, I wouldn't exactly say honest. He used to be one of FX Black's boys. He did a little extracurricular arm twisting, but nothing really serious until lately. He's taken up with some foreign whore and been seen sampling the less than legal delights at some of the kinkier nightclubs. Rumor has it he's been supplying her with drugs."
"Is this woman's name Azalee Rouge?"
"Something like that,"
Fade Out said. "What do you know about her?"
"Not much. Black, but light skinned, likes drugs, likes men. Can't stop the only one on her string."
"Do you have an address?"
"No. Look around. She's hard to miss."
"I have."
"Well?"
Fade Out said.
"I'm sorry I can't help. Tell you what, give me her phone number when you get it. I'd like to check her out myself."
"Sure. Do you have anything else for me?"
"I turned up something on that Morkel guy through our union connections. He's a longshoreman, a heavy equipment operator. Works the early morning shift at the Fulton Street docks. But the big news has to do with Worm."
"What about him?"
"Well, no one will say anything concrete, you understand. But there are whispers that he did an important job for Keane a couple of days ago, a job that no one else would handle."
And after a few moments of silence, Fade Out said,
"Hello? You still there? Hello?"
"Yes."
"Oh, okay. If you want to discuss things with him personally, he'll be at Lin's Curio Emporium later this morning, about 11 or so."
"The Chinese art shop on Mulberry?"
"That's right. You've heard of it?"
Brennan grunted a noncommittal reply. Linz was famous in the art world for his antiquities, and in the drug world as a notorious pickup spot where high-class clientele could get whatever they wanted in the way of illegal pharmaceuticals.
"Say, what's all this about that Azalee chick anyway?"
Fado asked. "I'll be in touch," Brennan said, then hung up. Worm. It had to be Worm, but this Morkel guy had been a thorn in his side since the start of the investigation. If Morkel worked the night shift at the docks, now would be the time to go after him. Worm would keep for a while. The small shower stall was crowded when Brennan entered. The water was cool against his body. Suddenly he wasn't so tired when Jennifer began to massage him with soapy hands. Tension and frustration swirled down the drain with the sweat and grime that had layered his body. First he'd run down the mysterious Doug Morkel, then Worm. But now it was just him and Jennifer. They kissed. Their soapy bodies entangling as they made languorous love under the cool, soothing spray of the shower.
"It's fine if you carry on your garment bag," the woman behind the Delta ticket counter told Jay. "But I'm afraid that your animal will have to be checked." "Yeah, sure," Jay said wearily. He lifted the cat carrier onto the luggage scale, too tired to argue. He'd been up half the night finding the damn thing. The Delta agent stapled a claim check onto his ticket envelope and handed it across the counter. Here you are, she said. Non-smoking window. The flight is already boarding.
Thanks, Jay said. He watched as she fixed the luggage tag to the handle of the gray plastic box and shifted it to the moving belt behind her. Jay had carefully lined the interior with old newspaper so nobody could see through the air holes. There didn't seem any point in waving goodbye. When the cat carrier had vanished into the depths of LaGuardia, Jay headed down the concourse toward his gate. Even at this hour of the morning, the airport was crowded, and he had to stand in line at security. A large sign by the X-ray machine warned that guns and bombs were no joking matter. Jay decided they wouldn't be amused if he mentioned that he had dynamite in his garment bag. The flight, scheduled for 6:55, departed 45 minutes late. Jay slept all the way to Atlanta.
9 a.m. The Fulton Street docks and the fish rendering plants and warehouses surrounding them were swarming with activity in which a man could hide out through doomsday.
Did Fadel say what this Morkel looks like?
Jennifer asked. Just that he's a heavy equipment operator. Brennan looked around with a frustrated frown. Must drive a forklift or something. We can eventually pinpoint him through Fadel's union connections. But I'd hoped we'd be able to run him down today. I'd hoped.
Let's give it a try.
They searched the docks for an hour before a man with a blue knit cap, a drooping mustache, and tattooed biceps as big as softballs nodded when Brennan mentioned the name.
Morkel! Yeah, I think I know him. Strange fella. He works down on Wharf 47.
Would he be there now? The longshoreman shrugged.
Could be. I think he usually works the night shift.
Thanks, Brennan said. One last thing. How'll we spot him?
Can't miss him. He's the guy without the forklift.
Without the forklift, Brennan repeated as a stevedore trundled his hand truck down the street. He looked at Jennifer and shrugged. The ship unloading at Wharf 47 was larger than most. A steady stream of large wooden boxes was wending its way down the gangplank and heading to the processing stations and market stalls bordering the docks. The stevedore had been right. Doug Morkel was easy to spot. He was 5 feet tall and almost as broad, with an immense chest and short, thick limbs. His face, Brennan thought, was oddly out of proportion to his body. It was long and narrow, with delicate, almost feminine features. It took Brennan several moments before he realized that the longshoreman looked like, of all people, Tachyon. He was carrying one of the huge crates without strain, balancing it with one hand atop his head. In that posture, he resembled photographs Brennan had seen of African women carrying pots of water, but pots of water didn't weigh close to half a ton. He walked steadily and easily, seemingly not at all encumbered by his massive burden.
Doug Morkel? Brennan asked.
The man glanced at him. Kept walking.
No, my name is Doug Morkel,
he grunted, the weight of the load making it difficult to speak clearly.
Ah, yes, your name's not Morkel. No, it's Morkel. Morkel.
Brennan glanced at Jennifer helplessly, and she gave it a try.
Could you spell that, please, Mr. Morkel?
He flashed Jennifer an angry look, stopped, and quickly shifted the crate, slamming it down to the dock.
What do you people want? My papers are in order. I have a green card.
He fumbled angrily in the pocket of his coveralls. He spoke perfect English, but with a peculiar accent that Brennan had never heard before. He shoved the piece of paper at Brennan. It had his photo and the name Durg Amurak Boza Voyawanza printed under it. He was born, it said, on Takis. The name on his union ID card, which he also handed to Brennan, had been Americanized to Doug Morkel.
Everything is in order, he said,
his anger turned to smugness. Yes, I see, Brennan temporized. This was utterly unexpected. Brennan remembered that Tachyon had once mentioned the Takisian who had been marooned on Earth back during the swarm troubles. Expert martial artist and casual killer, he was certainly capable of murdering Chrysalis. But what motive would he possibly have for killing her?
It says here on your union card that you're a heavy equipment operator.
Morkel stared at him through slitted eyes.
Are you from the union office?
That's right, Brennan lied.
My exemption has been filed,
Morkel said, triumph in his voice.
There is nothing wrong with my papers. The proper box is checked.
Uh-huh. Brennan looked again at the card, scanning it carefully. The special ace exemption box had indeed been checked, giving the bearer the right to function as a heavy equipment operator with or without the actual physical presence of such equipment, as long as he/she is remunerated at commensurate rates of compensation.
Of course, Brennan said. I must return to work. My shift is almost over.
Morgul held out a hand the size of a shovel.
My papers, please.
Do you always work the midnight to eight shift? The Tarkesian nodded impatiently and hoisted his burden. Last Monday, too? He nodded again, his anger obviously building. Well, thanks, Mr. Merkel.
That's Merkel,
he pronounced it with a liquid lilt at the end of the word.
Ideal. Will New Earthers ever learn how to speak correctly?
Do we believe him? Jennifer asked as they watched him stroll off with his burden.
It looks like an ironclad alibi.
Another dead end?
Brennan sighed. I'm afraid so. But that just made Worm look more and more like the prime candidate. It was time to interview him personally. First, though, Brennan decided, it would be sensible to return to the hotel room and pick up more firepower. He wasn't about to waltz into the Curio Emporium barehanded.
10 a.m. What the hell do you mean it never got put on the plane? I'm sorry, sir. The Delta luggage clerk wasn't nearly as good at being sorry as Waldo Cosgrove was. Our next flight from LaGuardia is due in about 20 minutes. I'm sure your luggage will be on that one. Behind her on the wall was a large poster covered with drawings of suitcases. If you could indicate the type of luggage, she said, it would help us locate the missing bags. It wasn't a suitcase, Jay said. It was a cat carrier, gray plastic, brand new. I just bought the damn thing. You have any idea how hard it is to find a 24-hour pet shop, even in Manhattan? He sighed. My cat's gonna be pissed. Oh, the poor thing, the lady said. I have five cats myself. I understand how you must feel. We'll find it, don't worry. If you give me your Atlanta address, I'll have your cat delivered. Great, Jay said. He thought for a moment. I don't know where I'll be. The convention has booked all the big hotels solid, I hear. Tell you what, deliver it to the Marriott Marquis, to Hiram Worcester. He spelled it for her. Our pleasure, she said as she completed the lost luggage form and handed it across the counter for signature. What's the little fella's name? Digger, Jay said. At least he hadn't checked the garment bag. He slung it over his shoulder and went out to look for a cab.
There's an envelope on your bookcase,
Jennifer said, looking at it as if it was some kind of poisonous reptile. What? Brennan called out from the bathroom. Another message?
Apparently.
Brennan came out of the bathroom, drying his hands on a towel. He joined Jennifer, who was staring at his bookcase and the small, plain, white envelope resting on it. This is getting weird, Brennan said.
Getting?
Brennan grunted and picked up the envelope. Inside was a single sheet of paper with a message written in the now familiar tiny hand, complete with his usual quota of spelling errors. For your own safety, he read, stay away from the Crystal Palace.
Why?
Jennifer asked. Brennan shook his head. Your guess is as good as mine. Our secret informant hasn't lied so far. It's been spooky as hell and gotten me into trouble a few times, but it's always told the truth.
Were you planning on going to the palace?
Jennifer asked. No. Right now I'm planning on heightening my appreciation of Chinese art. He folded the note and put it in his pocket, then hefted his bookcase. Let's go.
They stopped him the moment he stepped out of the revolving doors into the lobby of the Marriott Marquis. May I see your room key, sir? A black man in a security blazer asked him, none too politely. Jay gave him his most apologetic smile. Don't have one yet, he said. I'm just checking in. He tried to walk briskly around him, the garment bag slung over his shoulder,
The guard sidestepped, planting himself squarely in Jay's path.
"Hotel's full," he said. "We're not authorized to admit anyone but guests. Can I see some identification?"
"I've got business with one of your guests," Jay said. "Hiram Worcester. He's in the New York delegation."
"Is he expecting you?"
"Well," Jay admitted, "not exactly."
"Then I suggest you phone him. The desk will be glad to take a message. If he wants to see you, we'll arrange a pass."
Jay slapped his forehead, let his mouth hang open.
"A pass? You know, Hiram gave me a pass. How could I be so stupid? God, isn't that funny? You thinking I'm trying to get in without a pass, and here I've got one all the time."
"Hilarious," the man in the security blazer said. "Where did I put it?" Jay fumbled in his pocket for a moment, shaped his hand into a gun, drew it out.
"Here's my pass," he said, happily looking up.
Two tall men in dark suits were flanking the guy in the blazer, dark glasses hiding their eyes. Neither of them was smiling.
"I don't see a pass," the guard said. "I just see you pointing at me, asshole."
Jay looked at his finger. Then he looked at the men. There were three of them. The two on the ends had bulges under their jackets. He put his hand back into his pocket and took a step backward. The dark suits moved in, crowding him toward the wall.
"Oh, really? I was wearing my pass just a moment ago," Jay explained. "In all this crush, somebody must have brushed against me, knocked it off."
"That's so." The man looked at his partner and smirked.
"You know," Jay said, snapping his fingers, "come to think of it, I just remembered. My friend's in the Hyatt, not the Marriott. How could I be so stupid?"
Scuttling backward like a crab, grinning like a moron, he edged back through the revolving doors into the July heat of Atlanta. The feds watched him carefully every step of the way.
11 a.m. Lynn's Curio Emporium was located near the nebulous boundary between Jokertown and Chinatown. It was surrounded by other quality stores and expensive restaurants. Outside, it didn't really look like much. Inside, it was understated elegance. The carpeting was deep, rich red. The lighting was subdued and intimate. The curio cases scattered on the floor were antiques themselves. The screens and silks and statues displayed on the walls and in the cases were superb examples of Oriental art dating as far back as the Shang Dynasty, more than 1,000 years before Christ. Brennan was impressed by their wares. He was also impressed by the elegant floor clerk, who was as beautiful as any of the artifacts on display. She kept a watchful, if discreet, eye on Brennan since he entered the shop. Lynn's collection of artifacts was really extraordinary. Brennan had almost lost himself in contemplation of a case full of intricately carved jade censers when he looked up to see Jennifer hovering behind the sales clerk and making urgent gestures toward the rear of the building. It was time to go to work. He approached the clerk, who asked in a musical, lilting voice,
"Can I help you?"
Brennan laid his case flat atop one of the waist-high curio cabinets and smiled at her. "I believe so." He opened it and reached inside. "I would like to get this silk painting appraised."
"Oh, yes," she said,
leaning forward. A frown creased her exquisite features as Brennan pulled out a gun and pointed it at her. "Sorry," Brennan said. She looked at him quizzically as Jennifer materialized behind her and chopped her across the back of her neck. Brennan reached out and caught her before she hit the floor.
"No flirting with the help,"
Jennifer said as Brennan lowered her to the floor behind the counter. He ignored her statement. "What's going on in back?"
"Worm's in the back office, in conference with a small, middle-aged Chinese woman."
"Sui Ma," Brennan said.
"Who?"
"Kian's sister." He went past Jennifer and patted her cheek. "Lock the front door," he said. "It would be embarrassing if someone walked in on us." Brennan got his bow out and assembled it as Jennifer locked the front door and put out the closed sign. He went through the beak curtain that separated the shop's floor from the rear of the building and down the hallway beyond. The elegant ambience disappeared as he entered what was obviously a shipping and receiving area. It was deserted now, though dozens of boxes were lying around waiting to be packed or unpacked.
There was a small, glassed-off office in one corner of the shipping area. Sui Ma was sitting behind a desk in the office, and Worm was standing before her, packing a small suitcase. Fade-Out hadn't mentioned Sui Ma, Brennan thought. She was Kian's sister and head of the Immaculate Egrets, the Chinatown street gang that ran the Fist drug enterprises. She was plain and innocuous-looking, but as wily as her brother. Brennan went silently through the shipping area, creeping closer to the office, until he could hear what Worm was saying.
"With her dead, the secret is safe," Worm said.
There was no doubt in Brennan's mind as to whom Worm was referring. Anger burned brightly in him as he suddenly stood in the doorway, arrow drawn and aimed at the back of Worm's head. It was a startling entrance. Sui Ma gaped at him in astonishment. Then Worm also turned to stare. Brennan realized that Worm was packing plastic bags of blue powder into the false bottom of the suitcase. A small pile of clothes sat on the desk next to the suitcase. What looked like Worm's passport was balanced precariously atop the pile.
"Human!"
Sui Ma says sharply. She didn't blubber or bluster, but cut right to the heart of the matter.
"I thought that you and my brother had a truce."
"We did," Brennan replied, "until Worm killed Chrysalis."
"What?"
burst from both Sui Ma and Worm at the same time. Their feigned ignorance seemed almost believable.
"Who told you that Worm killed Chrysalis?"
Sui Ma demanded. "I have my sources," Brennan replied. "Besides, what were you talking about when I just came in? Whose death and what secrets?" Sui Ma burst out laughing.
"Live for tomorrow!"
Confused, Brennan lowered his bow slightly. "What?"
"Live for tomorrow," Sui Ma repeated. "It's a soap opera," she said.
Brennan felt a sense of immense dislocation. Soap opera?
"Yes, you see, Janice was killed in a car crash in yesterday's episode. So Jason's secret of actually being her love child is safe and he can marry Veronica."
"A soap opera?"
"Yes. Worm had missed a few episodes. I was filling him in while he packed his, delivery."
"Sure," Brennan said mockingly. He turned to Worm. "So you watch soap operas?" The hatred was still in Worm's eyes, but also something of a shameful expression, as if it had just been revealed that he was some kind of hideous pervert.
"Sometimes," he said defensively.
Brennan increased the tension on the bowstring and aimed right between Worm's angry eyes. "That's possibly the stupidest lie I ever heard. You better start talking, or you're one dead lizard, right now."
"About what?"
Worm hissed angrily.
"About Chrysalis," Brennan shouted. "Why did you kill her?"
Worm was about to make an angry reply when Jennifer suddenly stepped into the office through the wall.
"Wait," she said. "We'd better check this soap opera stuff."
She turned to Worm as Brennan lowered his bow a little. Worm stared at her with the hate and anger that he usually reserved for Brennan.
"So you watch Live for Tomorrow?" she asked.
"That's right,"
Worm spat out.
"Well then, who's Erica married to?"
Worm gave her a cold look.
"She just married Kobe last month," he said. "But what she doesn't know is that Ralph, her first husband, is not dead. He has amnesia and is being exploited by terrorists who have convinced him that he is Prince Rupert, a Takisian lordling who has come to Earth to cure the virus. But it's really..."
"All right," Brennan interrupted. He turned to Jennifer. "Is that crap right?" Jennifer nodded silently.
"Christ."
Brennan lowered his bow. His feeling of frustration redoubled. He fixed his attention on the bag Worm was packing. "Where are you taking that?"
"Havana,"
Worm said sullenly. "Step away from the desk." As Worm did, Brennan edged forward carefully. He released the tension on the bowstring so that he could hold the arrow on the string with one hand and picked up Worm's passport from the desk. He looked at the last stamped page. Apparently, this wouldn't be Worm's first trip smuggling Ratchet to Havana. He'd been in Cuba the day Chrysalis had been killed.
"Damn,"
Brennan said, throwing the passport back on the desk. Brennan's anger flared to an uncontrollable peak. He drew back the arrow he had ready. Worm hissed as it flashed by him, and then whirled to see that it had skewered a rat that had been sitting by the wall and eagerly observing the confrontation. When Worm looked back at Brennan, the archer had another arrow knocked and ready. "It appears,"
Brennan said angrily, that I got some bad information. The truce is still on. Worm hissed angrily as Brennan backed up out of the office. Jennifer followed him, watching Lazy Dragon's rat as it shrank and turned into a hunk of soap pinned to the office wall by Brennan's arrow.
Noon. What's going on? Jay said when the jokers fell in beside him. No one answered. No one even seemed to hear him. There were a dozen or more, grim-faced, quiet, sober. An old man was sobbing very softly to himself. Jay looked back over his shoulder and saw more jokers following behind them. Everyone seemed to be headed in the same direction. The garment bag was awkward. Jay moved it to his other shoulder, dropped back, fell in alongside a hulking joker whose green translucent flesh shimmied like lime jello as he walked. "Where's everybody going?" Jay asked him.
"The Omni,"
the jello man said. A woman bobbed in the air above him. She had no legs, no arms. She floated like a helium balloon, her pretty face red from crying.
"She lost the baby,"
she told Jay. Then she flew on up ahead. Jay let himself be swept up in the human tide that flowed through the streets of Atlanta. Thousands of feet all converging on the Omni Convention Center. Slowly, piece by piece, he got the story out of the jokers who walked briefly beside him. Early this morning, Ellen Hartman, the senator's wife, had suffered a tragic fall down a flight of stairs. She had been pregnant carrying Hartman's child. The baby had died. "Is Hartman going to withdraw?" Jay asked a man in a motorized wheelchair, whose ragged clothing covered his deformities.
"He's going on," the joker said defiantly. "She asked him to. Even through this, he's going on. He loves us that much."
Jay couldn't think of a thing to say. The jokers had begun drifting over, as the word had reached their encampments in Piedmont Park. Atlanta police and convention security watched the crowd swell with growing unease, but made no move to disperse them. Memories of the convention riots in New York in 76 and Chicago in 68 were still fresh in too many minds. By the time Jay arrived, the jokers had closed all the streets surrounding the convention. They sat on the sidewalks, covered the fenders of parked cars, filled every little patch of grass. They sat peacefully, wordlessly, under a blazing Georgia sun, with every eye fixed on the Omni. There was no shouting, no chants, no placards, no cheers, no prayers. There was no talk at all. The silence around the convention hall was profound. 11,000 jokers squatted together on the hot pavement, a sea of tortured flesh, pressed shoulder to shoulder in a silent vigil for Greg Hartman and his loss. Jay Aykroyd moved through them gingerly. He felt fuzzy and exhausted. It was over 100 in the shade, as humid as an armpit. Jay didn't even have a hat. The sun beat relentlessly against his head, and his headache was back screaming vengeance. His resolve had broken down, and he'd swallowed a couple of painkillers. But even that hadn't done more than dull the throbbing in his side and the pounding behind his eyes. There was nothing more anyone could do for the sick feeling in his gut. All around him, the jokers sat silently, watching, waiting. Some wept openly, but tried their best to stifle the sound of their sobs. Others hid their faces behind cheap plastic masks. But somehow, you could still feel their grief. Jay found that he could scarcely bear to look at them. None of them knew who he was or what he was doing here. None of them knew what he carried in the garment bag slung awkwardly over his shoulder, or what it would do to their hopes and dreams. But Jay knew, and the knowledge was making him ill. He took up a position across from the main doors of the Omni, where he could see the delegates and journalists come and go under the watchful eyes of security. Time seemed to pass very slowly. It got hotter and hotter.
TV crews panned their minicams endlessly across the sea of faces. News choppers hovered above them, and once the turtle glided past overhead, his passage as silent as the crowd. The shadow of his shell giving the Jokers a momentary respite from the sun. Later, a small woman in black satin tails and top hat emerged briefly from inside the convention hall and surveyed the crowd through a domino mask. Jay recognized her from the news. Topper, a government ace, assigned to bodyguard Gore, probably reassigned, now that her man had dropped his candidacy. He thought about trying to get her attention, handing over the bloodstained jacket, making it somebody else's dilemma. Then he remembered her colleague, Carnifex, and thought again. When Topper went back inside, a gaggle of delegates emerged through the open doors. One was a huge man with a spade-shaped beard, who moved lightly in spite of his size. His impeccable white linen suit made him look cool, even in this terrible heat. Jay got to his feet.
Hiram!
He shouted over the heads of the Jokers, waving his arm wildly despite the dull flare of pain in his side. In the silence of the vigil, Jay's shout seemed like some obscene violation. But Hiram Worcester looked up, saw him, and made his way through the crowd, as ponderous and stately as a great white ocean liner sliding through a sea of rowboats.
Popinjay, he said when he got there. My God, it is you. What happened to your face?
Never mind about that, Jay said. Hiram, we gotta talk.
What was all that about? Jennifer asked.
Brennan was still seething. A setup, a goddamn setup.
What?
Brennan looked at Jennifer. We weren't set up. Worm and Sui Ma were.
I see, I think.
Let's find a phone. There was one on the corner. Brennan dialed and Fade Out picked it up on the second ring.
Hello?
I don't like to be lied to, Brennan said softly.
Well, cowboy, nice to hear from you at a decent hour.
Did you hear what I said?
Well, sure. What's it in reference to? I didn't get the dope on Morkel wrong, did I?
That was fine, Brennan said. The dope on Worm wasn't quite as accurate.
Oh?
He had nothing to do with Chrysalis's death. He was in Havana when she was killed.
Oh, well, sorry.
Greasy weasel, Brennan thought. I'm not your private executioner, Brennan said grimly.
It was an honest mistake.
Don't compound the lie, Brennan said. I'll be in touch.
Wait,
Fade Out said before Brennan could hang up.
Anything on Chrysalis's files yet?
Brennan put the phone down without answering.
1 p.m. It's simply not possible, Hiram said after Jay had finished telling his story.
No.
Jay unzipped the garment bag, brought out the jacket, and laid it on the table between them. Yes, he said. The cocktail lounge was one of those places that was as dark at noon as it was at midnight. It was well away from the convention, deserted enough to give them a little privacy. The air conditioning was set way below Arctic blast, but beads of sweat trickled down Hiram's broad forehead into his neatly trimmed beard. The booth was a tight fit for the ace's imposing bulk, his ample stomach pushing up hard against the table, but when Jay put down the jacket, Hiram seemed to squirm backward, as if he were afraid to touch it.
This is some kind of grotesque misunderstanding. Greg is a good man. I've known him for years, Jay, for years.
Jay touched the jacket. You were with Hartman in Syria. Is this the jacket or isn't it? Hiram forced himself to look at the jacket.
It appears to be, he said. But Jay, an off-the-rack sport coat? They manufacture them by the thousands. It has to be a fraud. It has to be.
I don't think so, Jay said. Stigmata had no reason to lie. He didn't even realize what he had. The other jacket was the fraud. Kahina never trusted Gimli. She gave him a double. Probably used her own blood. So a test would show the presence of the virus. That was what Gimli gave to Chrysalis. The real one Kahina kept for herself. She must have had her own plans. But Hartman and Mackie Messer didn't give her the time to carry them out.
Then, Hiram said hesitantly, Chrysalis died for nothing. For a phony jacket.
The assassin she hired wasn't phony.
No, Jay admitted. George Kirby is real. The hell of it is, right now, I'm not sure if I'm rooting for him or against him.
You can't mean that, Hiram said in horror. What Chrysalis did makes her no better than the Nur. Murder is murder. I don't care what she knew or thought she knew. If she had charges to make, she should have come forward and made them. Doesn't Greg deserve the opportunity to defend himself? Jay, I tell you, this is all wrong. If you knew Greg Hartman the way I do, he's such a fine man. So much courage. In Syria, if you'd only seen the way he stood up to the Nur al-Ala, you'd have been so proud. To accuse him of such monstrous crimes. And based on what? What? The testimony of Digger Downs?
Hiram was getting angry now.
The man's a professional liar, Jay. How many times have I had to throw him out of Aces High?
That's not the issue, Hiram, Jay said. Hiram Worcester frowned, one hand curled into an impotent fist on the table in front of him.
Where is Downs? Hiram demanded. I want to look into his eyes and hear the story for myself. I'll know if he's lying, and I swear, if he is...
The airline lost him, Jay said ruefully. The cat carrier hadn't been on the flight after his, or the flight after that one either. Delta said on the next plane for sure. Never mind. Hiram looked confused. He drained half his Pim's cup in a series of long gulps. His hand was shaking when he put it back on the table.
You didn't say who you think actually did the business. With Chrysalis, I mean.
Let's just say I'm going to be real interested to find out what Billy Ray was doing on Sunday night and Monday morning.
Billy Ray, Hiram said. My God, that's absurd. He's a Justice Department operative. You can't think the whole federal government is involved in this, surely.
Jay shrugged. Until somebody proves otherwise, I'm not trusting anyone I don't have to. Hiram finished his drink. He looked down at the empty glass, but his eyes had turned inward. So many people have worked so hard. We've all done so much. You saw those poor souls in the street. Greg's their only hope. What will they do if it's true? Vote Republican? The quip was a half-hearted effort, and the minute it was out, he regretted it. It was far too flip for the circumstances, for Hiram's genuine grief. But Hiram scarcely seemed to hear it. He pulled out a black silk handkerchief from his lapel and used it to mop his brow. The huge man looked confused and lost. Too weak to carry all that flesh.
There's a reporter, he said slowly. Sarah Morgenstern. She's been telling everyone that Greg is a killer ace. No one believed her. She's not a very stable person.